Hi, I'm Josh, and sometimes I find that when I'm a little bit tired or like a little bit drunk or a little bit stoned, I tend to sound a little bit like James Franco. And I guess maybe that makes me like francophonic a little bit.
Interesting. Hi, I'm Matt, and I... Inspired by the success of Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, but a little upset with how he can sometimes be rather old-fashioned in his views, I decided to make a competing show that would be Boys in Trees Building Treehouses. And I think that's all I have to say. Yeah, I'm done. Good.
I would like to go on record as saying treehouses are a goddamn lie. I think just sort of like where Josh and I grew up, like all we had was tall trees that go straight upward. And it's like, you ain't gonna put a house in there. No way. And you see them on TV and the movies, and you just long for the ability to climb up in a tree and sit in a little room, but you can't.
I do feel bad if you guys did not have the experience I had of having like many tree houses over the course of my youth.
No, yeah. We built them on the ground.
Yeah, it's ground houses. It's
just... That's not a tree house. That's a fort.
Yeah.
We built forts. You're a fort.
It is my fort to build those.
I'm a fort knight.
Correct.
We had a
pronunciation. No.
We had a friend who built one. His parents built a platform so they could build the treehouse on top of it, but it was fucking 4 feet off the ground.
Oh, see, my dad did a thing that, as an adult, you could walk under. That was four by four, sunk in with a thing, and then built a room, and then we built a zip line down from that, and that was great. But that wasn't dangerous enough. So when they started building other houses out in the little subdivision we lived in a few miles out of town, we would steal lumber from the construction sites, go to the other side of the road into the woods behind the neighbor kid's place, climb up in trees and just hammer shit in.
Yeah.
And like those were way more interesting because eventually it became, don't go in that treehouse. Everything's rotted. Let's build a new treehouse. And so that was where we ended up with like seven over the course of my childhood.
Treehouse slumlord.
Yeah, mine was always safe and you knew you could play there without dying. It was even like painted and shit. And then we had the ones that were like, well, these ones are cool because they have a trap, which is just this part of the floor rotted away. Anyway, who's that third guy?
Oh, yeah. That's, well, hello. So you might ask how I ended up naked in the emergency room with a fly swatter stuck up my nose and a bug zapper stuck, it all started with the butterflies.
I am willing to let that mystery lie.
I feel like it. And, you know, let's get this going before I wake or before I sleep.
or
until
during.
It sleeps. Because you got some Harsho hot dog happening right now.
Yes, true.
Everybody's a fucking mess.
Consummate professionals.
That's what we got.
Consummate V's.
Yeah, we're consummating as we speak. So we watched three films that are found on Netflix, but first we watched a short film that can only be currently found on Shudder, and that short is called Cheswick, and
Creswick.
Yeah. I thought it was Cheswick.
Creswick.
Fezzik?
Yes, Fezziwig.
It's inconceivable that we would have planned ahead of time.
Anyway. We watched a short called Moose.
Yeah. Nice.
A short called Creswick, which is available on Shudder as part of the Nighthawks collection of horror, like best short horror. So, instead of watching that short, I had a serious talk with my son. And, you know, it went well. Nobody yelled, nobody cried. It's good.
It's good.
But I don't have much to say about this short, so you guys go ahead, and I'll wait for you here.
So, to run down the brief beats of this, it appears that adult daughter is helping dad kind of move out of what looks like a pretty cool old farmhouse.
Yeah, it kind of seems like kind of a, you know, sort of like a, it started out with a basic house and then like added a shed and then added a barn for a workshop. And then
yeah,
added, you know, like,
I mean, it's...
It kind of seems like one of those type of properties.
It is not unlike the houses that, like, my dad's side of the family lives in out in Marshall, which is, like, 2.5 hours west of the cities, where, like, my uncle still lives and is a pig farmer and shit. Like, it's very much like the house and the outbuildings. It's got that look, a little smaller scale. Like, they don't look like they would have, like, tractors and shit, but, like, epic workshop, you know? And they're kind of chatting and whatever. And he's like thanking her for helping out, and she's like, no, I'm happy to be here. He's like, are you kidding? When you were a kid, you hated it here. You always couldn't wait to get back to your mom's. And he's like, but I get it. Like, that's why I'm moving. Like, I feel like I'm not the only one here. Sometimes the door is open or closed or whatever, and I swear I did it right. And she kind of visits him out in the shop, and they're packing things up. And she has a couple of visions of, like, the long path with trees placed on the sides, and way, way off in the distance where if you squint, you can just see a dark figure and another smaller dark figure, and they're maybe holding hands walking towards you. And she hears some weird noises and things and finds a rabbit she put in a box suddenly in a cupboard later.
Yeah, let's go back. Let's go back real fast to that rabbit bit. That is one of those things that, like, you know, we are all of a certain age where you put something down and you turn like, what the fuck did I do with that thing? And
it's like, yeah, but your glasses are on the top of your head. Yeah, exactly.
We've all done this kind of thing, whatever else. Where it's just like, it's right there. I'm holding my fucking phone and I can't find my phone. That kind of situation.
God,
this is
I've
one of those
done
things
that.
Where like they've been packing stuff up and she goes to open a medicine cabinet and in is the stuffed rabbit, and it's like, that is goosebump moment number one.
Where it's just really like, good.
Gugh. And it's not a bumpy, shouty, like flash cut thing. It's just like she opens the cabinet and it's like, that fucking rabbit's there.
Yeah,
like,
this Jesus. the entire short is very quiet, which I appreciate.
Yeah, it's very confident in that regard. Like it's very it's not apologizing for what's the,
there's
the
no
scary
sudden,
stuff.
There's no sudden violins or anything.
It's real.
But at some point she
neat.
In the middle of the night or whatever, she wakes up and she's like sees the light on in the shed and the door's open. So she heads out there, and the drill press is running, but the hunk of wood is just spinning on the thing. You know that thing that happens in shop class when you fuck up? And she's looking at these gorgeous chairs her dad's been making. She's like, yeah, they're part of a set. And as she looks down the road, they're getting progressively weirder.
Oh, my God. That's
things you
that's
cannot sit on. And you're like, that. I literally have goosebumps right now.
Yeah,
and it's just like, that's fucked. And you keep waiting for the boogity. And you're like, all right. And so she just kind of goes, okay, and she turns off the drill press, comes back inside, and her dad sees her as she's like at the door, and he goes, oh, are you leaving? And she's like, no. And he goes, okay, good. I feel safer when you're here. And she's like, okay. And he goes, go to bed. And he's like, well, I've been locked up. She's like, I'll take care of it. So she shuts the door and locks it. And when she looks at him down the hall, there is a emaciated skeletal figure, black, not like a black person, but like, you know, and it's slumped over his shoulder like it's a weight on him.
Mm-hmm.
And then the head turns and looks at her and opens the eyes, and he just saunters off to bed. And whew, again, goosebumps.
Yeah.
It is so fucking perfectly pitched. And I still have no idea what to think of how, what that's supposed to mean. And that was my first question for you, Charlie, is do you know if this is like a folklore thing? Because these people also have accents from somewhere.
I think she's Australia. It's Natalie Erica James is the lady who directed it.
Okay. Or this could just be a spoopy idea, but it felt very folkloric almost, which maybe that's just a testament to what they're doing.
Well, that's kind of the vibe. It just does definitely feel that way for sure. But also, too, there's also a bit that she – earlier where she's talking about what was the thing? Darn it, I'm trying to fell out of my head. Where she's like going through the box of stuff and she's got her like journal in there.
Oh, the sketchbook or whatever.
Yeah, she's got her like kind of little sketchbook deal in there, and there's like there's one drawing in particular that's like it looks like the trees. Kind of, it looks like kind of that
with the
long,
figure way at the end.
Yeah, it looks like there's something down there. She kind of just shuts it. Which, the thing that her dad says, it's like you get the sense that like there's a lot going on here that was just not talked about, you know. And it's just sort of like there's just a lot of unsaid stuff and unaddressed stuff.
Yeah, and it kind of makes sense that like when she was a kid, you know, she would have picked up, because kids are great at picking up on mood and things, like she would have picked up on it and he would have done his best to make it seem not scary or even let her acknowledge that there's anything to perhaps be worried about, because that's your job as a parent, is to comfort your kids. And then now that she's an adult, he's got that role now of being glad there's someone there to comfort him, because it sounds like he's been there alone.
Yeah.
And like how tough has it been for him every night if you get up and have to pee? Do you go or do you lay in bed and wait till it's light out? Like, I feel like he's in a position where he probably lays in bed and waits till it's light out. And that's a cool, creepy thing to kind of, evoke in your,
well,
in
and
your
also,
short.
And also, too, he says the thing about the, you know, things, doors open weird and like objects are around various places and they're not in the right places, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like, you think, yeah, it's kind of creepy. But then like you're saying about him being there alone, it's sort of like, you also have nobody to validate anything or to help or to like console or to, you know, make you be less freaked out or, you know, that kind of stuff. Like none of that.
It's the same thing as, you know, a daughter going, I swear I just put this bunny away. You know, there's a little hint of that. I think it's obvious enough that there's something goofy and that kind of confirms dad's suspicions. But like, it is that thing where if you're in a house alone, you're like, well, did I shut the door to that? Or did I not shut it tight enough? Or, you know, like, or is it swinging on a hinge because I'm in a very obviously old farmhouse? Like, you'd have moments of like questioning yourself.
Oh, sure.
You'd have moments of being scared. You know, it's that thing where, it was on like Jordan Jesse Go this week. They were talking about having roommates and Jordan's like, I've not had a roommate in so long. I'd be afraid to have one now because I can't tell how weird I've gotten because I've been living alone and I can do anything I want. I could be crazy by now and would not know it until there's someone else in the room going, you don't butter toast with your dick or whatever. Like, you know, like this is not how that goes.
That makes me think of Robert Earl Keane talking. I think he was on Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's talking about like him and his wife having a place cut out in the country, sort of outside of Austin, if I'm remembering right, or somewhere, or maybe it's outside of Nashville. Either way, like they kept buying properties further and further away from the city. And he's like, I came out one morning, and I was just in my underwear, and I had to get the shotgun to chase away some foxes. And I'm standing there in my underpants with the shotgun, and my wife said, you know, we should probably move closer to the city.
Yeah, like, that was, yep. I think that was similar to what, Penn said, when he had his original, the slammer outside of Vegas. He moved far out enough to be a nut. And that was just kind of the thing. There's definitely something to isolation and loneliness that can creep in from the corners and sort of make it so that everything gets a bit of a unhinged dreamlike quality easily enough. And if there's actually something going on, which there appears to be here, that's pretty bonkers. They have Chekhov's sandwich that is never fired in this short.
That was so sad with the damn sandwich.
Yeah, she comes out and dad's working on like the table saw and there's just sawdust spraying everywhere. And she walks in and kind of glances at the table and there's like, a little sandwich she's made and cut for him. And she must have set it down behind him or mentioned it briefly. She's like, I slaved away on that sandwich. She's like, oh, I'm really sorry. Like, I guess I was in the zone, you know, whatever. And she's like, oh, whatever. And they show you the sandwich is covered in sawdust. And then when she comes out at night and steals the weird shit, the sandwich is still there. And I was like, oh shit, if that sandwich is gone, I'm going to be real upset because there's all these weird furniture now. And no, the sandwich is still there. And I was like, bastards. No. You had me so focused on that sandwich that when you did the thing with the dude slumped over his shoulder, I had no expectation of that. And there is, like I said, no strong violin musical boogly cue on that. No, it's just... Well, it's what you would experience in real life seeing that. It would just be a quiet moment. Yeah. Chairs has the drill press sound.
Well, that sound in the background, which is unnerving as it is. But just as you're going, these very beautiful chairs, as you go, and they just start getting more and more jacked up. And it's like, hats off to these people because, like, that is some production through the goddamn roof because,
yeah,
you know, that took time. I mean, you look at them, they are built things.
Those are all custom built.
Yeah, they're and they're beautiful and but it's just there's just
by the second or third to last chair, I was like, these would be in an like an art installation in the Walker here, because they're just like, you know, like in what was the movie with Duder playing his own twin, and they have like the gynecological tools for an alien.
Yeah, Dead Ringers.
So it's like, it would be that same thing, like chairs for alien species. Like, it could be that kind of thing that someone would put
butts
in
a butts
that
man
spot.
Is not meant to...
No. Man, it's weird. So anyway, absolutely check this out. I think this is fucking great.
Well, and also, too, that Nighthawk Shorts Festival thing they put together, Sammy Zimmerman is one of the guys that put it together. And there's some other really good ones in that group. There's a lovely one before this one on there called Your Date Is Here, which is a nice little, mean little, as Josh would say, sour ball. That's really good in there. And there's some other really good ones. I would say honestly, like this is the last one on that collection, but it's literally like an hour and 18 minutes, something like that. I mean, it's worth watching all of them, cause they did a good job of putting it together. I think they did a very good job.
As a guy who knows some guys that do a short film festival, I am very happy to go back now and watch the rest of these, because I can happily sit through an hour of shorts and see what I think of them. I love that. That, to me, is a pretty fun idea. So, features?
Yay!
Featuring? Yeah. First feature of the week is The Boys in the Trees, or Los Hijos en los Árboles.
Oh, I like that one.
Wait,
that's a good one.
Arboles?
Yeah, arbolist tree.
So, is an arbolist based on like the idea that you're shooting hunks of wood at people?
A what?
Arbolist, like a person would use like a crossbow.
Crossbows are made of wood?
Yes, and so is an arrow, usually.
My story checks out.
that would be interesting if it was like related
arboreal.
Our work here is done.
Sure.
Arbor Day.
But I mean, that's what I just wondered. Like, it suddenly made me connect like all these ideas and go, oh, like
maybe
the more you know,
the more we think we know, sort of, because I mean, Spanish and Latin have a lot of common
roots for things,
but then there are the things that are just bug nutty.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, boys in the trees. I keep going, the boys in the trees. Like, no, wait. So it's just
boys in
trees. It's just boys in trees. No, it's boys and the trees.
Yeah, not like a berry, not like a boys and berry.
Boys and berries is what we watched. So set in Australia in what, 1997?
Yep.
I think, but filmed in 2016. Interesting cross-cultural stuff, like
pitched perfectly for the three of us, I would imagine.
Yeah.
The fact that every song that comes on, you're like, oh, I listened to the shit out of this, whether I wanted to or not, on the radio.
Because it's 97 in Australia, which is American culture from like 94, 95.
Give or take, yeah.
So yeah, this is perfect. And they're having the last day of school, which then they have like a week off or a weekend off and then exams. But it's also Halloween because the seasons are reversed in Australia. And so they're Halloween, but at the beginning of summer, but everyone's wearing hoodies, and like it's
really weird.
A really interesting like air of like, unreality.
Yeah, you know? it made the whole, and honestly, I couldn't tell it was a period piece for a little bit, and I was like, oh, some of the language and stuff here seems really bizarre and outmoded. Maybe this is supposed to be like a really small town where people still say fag. I don't know if there are towns where that still happens or whatever, but like, and all of a sudden you go, oh shit, this is 1997. Everybody said faggot.
Yeah,
like, oh my god. Wow, what a weird choice. And then the farther you get into the movie, the more I was like, I just lived this. Mm-hmm. Like, this is astounding. So this is, for me, this is my Breakfast Club. it's great. Anyway.
So we have a kid who's on his last day of school, is not happy with the small town he's living in, looking at maybe escaping to New York, but he's got this group of dipshit friends.
Little knowing, eventually he'd have to escape from New York.
Yeah. Because la-di-da-di, phone John Gotti, he came to New York. He came to New York.
Well, anyway. You've out-nerded me. Good job. I went for a Broad Carpenter reference, and you... what was that?
I had some song that was on radio for a bit.
Fun Loving Criminals, I believe. That's
holy shit, they just popped up on something else I was looking at. I was like, I looked up that Scooby Snacks song, and I was like, oh shit.
Jesus, yeah.
Yeah.
They were on Cracked because they're still big in the UK.
Yeah, big in the UK, which is not as cool as big in Japan because Tom Waits is better.
Yes.
It's a loving crime, I guess.
I guess.
No, they're fun loving criminals. They love fun and they do
crime.
They
happen to be criminals.
Right.
They probably have to fund their fun habit.
The fun fund with criminal activity.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so the fun loving criminals that hang out with this kid.
I mean, in a way, that is kind of the plot. Yeah,
you've got like dudes who are obviously just the followers, the remora that are kind of locked on.
Well,
to
you've
the,
got
the shark,
Hitler Youth, and then all the kids around him that are sort of afraid to cross him, but also sort of enjoy doing all the bold shit he'll do. And then our protagonist, who is like that dude's best friend, who is learning that maybe that's not cool anymore.
I think just like starting to have ideas and a conscience.
Well, and this whole movie to me is him learning to have his own identity.
Yeah.
Because you watch him in at least two or three occasions quote Hitler Youth.
Right.
And watch other people go, oh, I kind of was willing to have a real conversation with you, and you're spouting juvenile bullshit. And you see him go, I didn't really believe that. I just said it.
Well, and even
and you see that weigh on him.
Well, in his conversation with Jonah later, when we talk about the dance formal, whatever else, and he's kind of remembering, you know, doing this, drugs, or drinking, doing whatever, all this kind of stuff. And,
yeah.
And then he just goes, and then Jonah's like, oh, I didn't go to the formal. And then there's like this, there's a bit of a pause, and he just says, oh, you didn't miss much. And it's like, there's so much going on in lines like that. It's like, man.
That is like a conversation I've had.
That's the thing. Like,
it is,
not showy.
So hard to watch.
And,
no,
like,
no.
It's not big,
it's just
a Hallmark channel. It's just sort of like, it just is. It just sits there. And, you know, kudos to the fellow, the writer director, Nicholas Verso. Like there are many moments. I mean, okay. Just to interrupt myself, like, how many times could they have fucked this up in this story?
Constantly.
I mean, like, every single turn, like, there's so many instances where there's so many opportunities for them to take an easier route or take a kind of a cheesier whatever. And they just don't. It's amazing. It's almost like, it's almost otherworldly to watch them put this together and not go down any of those pitfalls. It's really neat. It's like, man.
Yeah, this movie, at least for me, and I think because it is absolutely pitched to be for the age I am, this is, like I said, this is my Breakfast Club. This is what high school is actually like, as opposed to things like Grease that try to give you like what you wish high school was. And the Breakfast Club was supposed to be like, we're all different and dicks, but then they have the happy ending. And it's like, that's not how that works. Like, you either get rid of these people and move on with your life, or you stay these people.
Yeah.
And so for me, our protagonist, who, is definitely following a crowd, wants to get out of his shithole town, wants to go somewhere away where there's actual shit happening, you know, yada, yada, yada. All that is perfectly familiar to me. That is literally my life story. And then watching him also be incapable of having his own thoughts until a couple people kind of slap him around and go, bruh, you gotta snap out of this. Like, you can't say you're this guy while we're talking and then still act like this. And he has a couple good examples. And the fact that he just completely ditches a good friend to have safer social circumstances, a thing I've done. Most of us, if you were ever lucky enough to be in good social standings, have probably ditched someone who is not that lucky. Like, that's, I think, almost always happens if you are ever lucky enough to be semi-popular for a second. You probably have to stop hanging out with someone else. And those are things that I think about a lot. Every now and then something happens in my life and I regret a thing I said once when I was 16 or 15 or 14. And I think about a lot when I talk to my son and my daughter. And this movie hits so many of those beats. And because of the era, the soundtrack in the background
is
the music I was listening to, where, you know, we'd be like, oh, because the thing where they're like rolling out on Halloween night wearing their masks to go vandalize shit, and they got fucking Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson playing, and we're like, that's a bit on the nose. And you go, oh no, that is absolutely what they'd be playing on their boombox if it's 1997. You know, and then Megan's like, oh shit, this Rammstein song. You know,
that was amazing.
It's just thing after thing.
Because
and then,
it wasn't Du Hast.
Yeah, exactly. It was one that you would, if you owned that album because you were in that era, you would listen to that track. And then the moment later in the movie where someone's singing and you realize you're listening to Live.
Yeah.
And you just go, fuck, that's a clever, subtle choice. Because while they were huge for like a minute, no one talks about them anymore.
Well,
and so like Marilyn Manson, everybody knows. Rammstein, people know.
They were one of the headliners at ACL this last year.
Were they really?
Yeah, they
but
were.
Kowalczyk's not with the band anymore.
That is not headlining.
Well, but,
unless the festival closed at 6.
But Charlie was there.
I always forget that. In addition to all your other talents, you're also a hair splitter. Shit.
Have you seen his hair?
That to me would be just past opener, no one shows up in time for, and middling act that we can put on the bill in the slightly larger font. So,
but no. Charlie, are they back with Ed Kowalczyk?
Yeah, he was there.
Oh, interesting.
Well, we watched most of their set.
They put out an album and were touring, and I listened like to the sample of the album. And I was like, shit, Ed's voice changed. And I looked at the picture like, I don't see Ed in there. And they did an entire fucking tour and an album as Live without him.
Oh, interesting.
Which is, I mean, that would be like Marilyn Manson doing a tour without Marilyn Manson.
Well, I guess it depends on how the band's constructed, but yeah, it'd be true.
I mean, he's the guy, after the first couple albums, he's the guy who wrote all the songs and sings all the songs. So that, you know, that's a shitty thing to do.
Yeah. But you know, I guess when I talk to groups of people I know, they go, yeah, I remember that band. But that's all anybody has for live.
It's just funny that you're talking to two people who are like, just fuck yeah, live. I've got multiple albums.
A work shirt I made by buying a live patch and having it stitched on so I could have a live t-shirt. I've got like three still. I was super fan, man. There's a framed case you can see on the shelf over there where I went. My first concert ever was live in Somerset, Wisconsin. And in that case is the article in the Star Tribune Variety section that was the front page talking about that concert, my ticket stub, and the drumstick I caught at that show.
Nice.
Yeah, because
that's awesome. That's very cool.
Yeah, dude, my first concert was as good as a concert gets.
So you're like,
it was dope. I'm like, this is what music is. And then just went to show, started getting kicked in the face. It's like, oh, music can be different.
Turns out that they alone love me. They alone tempt me.
Oh, that's good. But anyway, that's a large digression.
A couple of other little touchstones that I wanted to note real fast too, talking about the era. And this might be something with Australian culture to American culture, but in his room, he's got that MJ poster that
the Wingspan one.
Yeah. And everybody that I knew that this is going to sound kind of awful to say, I guess, but I don't mean it to sound that way, but a lot of either people that were lame or people that had parents that worked a lot and just sort of bought them stuff, had that. And they also had the Jordans, or they had the whatever. And it was sort of this compensatory thing. And I kept thinking about his dad and his mom not being around or whatever else and that whole situation. And it made me wonder, is dad just sort of oh, we'll go to the mall on the weekend, or, oh, we'll get this, or we'll get that, or, that kind of thing. They don't really go into it, but I just kept thinking about that poster and the people that I knew that had it. And I was like,
I think the truth of that relationship that you described, I think, is there. I would say, though, that poster for me was another thing that cemented the era.
Oh, for
because,
sure. Oh, totally.
Like, looking around his room at all the posters, I was just like, oh, shit. Because everyone I knew that liked sports to any degree had either the Wingspan poster or the one with Bo Jackson with the football shoulder pads holding the bat over him.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Everyone had one or two or both of those. Because that era was just, that was what you had. Because if you were of the age to be that, you grew up in the 80s. So, it's a little late to have that. But again, the idea that culture takes a little time to filter down. But the thing, I don't have the same association. To me, that is simply, if you liked basketball, you had that. And so it was just, because also we had, what was this, 1997? You're only 3 years after the Bulls did a three-peat in the championships. So it's not that far off from someone just being a legit Michael Jordan fan.
I could
also
see that.
That's one of the few sports things I know.
You can also imagine.
I just said I knows.
the you noses. You got big smarts. You can also imagine that him as a 13-year-old getting that poster.
Oh, 100%.
And putting it up in his room, and then all of the band posters come later.
There's also sometimes cultural currency. I put up a ton of sports posters for a while because all my friends love sports. And there used to be, I assume there's not anymore, there used to be a magazine, Sports Illustrated, for kids.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a little thin one, and they had the interviews and stuff. And in the middle was always a poster. So I would always check one out from the library at my little Catholic school, and I would, while no one was watching, I would pull out the posters from four of them, stick them in the middle of the one I was checking out, take them home, and I'd put those posters up on my wall. So I had Karl Malone, and I had, Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and all that, Clyde Drexler or whatever. And I'd put them all up, and I had never watched a game of basketball. I've seen one NBA game in my life ever. And that was when I was already married. So this is completely irrelevant to this experience. I was middle school here. Actually, elementary school. And I would, on the
Wait,
back
that
have stats and stuff.
You weren't married in elementary school?
Oddly enough. Huh. It seems like I would be the kind of guy, yeah. But,
sorry.
I would put all these posters up, and on the back that have stats and info, and I would sit in my room at night and read these and try to memorize them. So that when people would talk about sports ball, I would be able to be part of it. And if people came to my house, I could look normal. And that, to me, is exactly what our protagonist could be doing. And if not in that regard, is certainly doing in some other ways throughout this movie by just trying to be part of it. Taking the picture of the kid who bloodies his nose. That's his former friend, we should probably get back to the plot. But that is clearly a moment of you have sympathy for this kid. And then you realize who you're standing around and go, the only move I have here is to either ignore this or take a picture of it so we can all laugh.
Right.
And he's constantly doing things that aren't in his nature or his character to maintain safety in the social status.
Well, did which you not get the impression from him that, like, he's got the dipshit friends or the, that group of friends, whatever else, but he, our guy, Corey, right? Is the main guy.
Yeah.
It's like our guy is probably still getting mostly A's, but he just doesn't like let on, you know?
I would imagine as long as his friends don't know what grade he's getting, he'd be perfectly comfortable getting AIDS.
Not 80s.
Por que no los dos. But I would say, I bet as far as he can hide that fact from his friends, he would absolutely be doing that, because if he plans to go to New York and go to school for photography, he's not going there on money. You know, so I feel like, yeah, he's the kid who's secretly building a life that his, quote unquote extracurricular activities are not demonstrating.
He goes out and smashes
mailboxes and gets drunk, but then is fucking acing every test and then acting like, yeah, psh, whatever, it's just stupid test, it was so easy, but not acting like he'd probably actually worked hard to make sure he did that, because he knows he needs that scholarship.
That was another one where it was sort of like, it's like she's a fascinating character, and like the shot of her when she's back at her house and she's taking off her makeup and kind of like settling back out into like kind of normal sort of thing. Like it's not this bullshit at the cemetery and all this kind of stuff and all those kind of things. Like, God, that made her interesting. I was just fascinated by her, like, and her relationship with him too. 'Cause she's probably watched him for a while. Like, damn it. Like, if I could just grab him by the nostrils and get him to stop acting like a dummy. Like, I know how good of a person this guy really is.
Well, I mean, they literally have that conversation.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like, she's not just a wallflower. She's not just, like, a pointless wallflower, you know? Like, that's one of the things I really like about her character and about their relationship is, like, she actually has weight and she has, like, merit, and she has her own goals. They aren't his goals. You know, they make a pact.
Is also actually pretty awesome. She is autonomous.
And that they don't go off so together at the end.
Real quick, just to kind of, if you didn't see it, to catch people up to where we're at this point in the movie. So you've got the guy we're calling our guy, Corey, and his best friend. I forget his name, but I've just been calling him Hitler Youth.
Django.
It's Django.
So yeah. Django has been running Hitler around with a little pack of douchebag friends at a skate park. He gets bumped into by some little kid in a sweatshirt who I guess is the same age, maybe a year younger, but is just not as big.
Yeah, you know. Puberty. He talks about later how puberty kind of passed him by.
Yeah, which again is like, looking at how tiny my son is, I'm like, whoa, you know? And like, so you, and they, you know, he smacks him in the face or whatever, and they take a picture, and then they all go out to destroy shit on Halloween night, and they photocopy the photo of the kid's bloody nose as he's laying on the ground and post it all over town. They go to his house and TP it and throw like a dead crow at his window or some shit. And they all go drinking at the graveyard with a bunch of girls, where our guy, Corey, kind of fucks up when he's talking to the gal we were just talking about, whose name I just forgot, Night Shift Girl, by sounding too much like Hitler Youth when she was trying to have a legitimate moment with him.
Yeah.
And she just bails on him. She's like, cool, I guess you're dumb. And we watch a little hooded sweatshirt kid with the bloody nose go off drinking by himself by a river somewhere and then smash the bottle and be pissed off. And so our boy, Corey, is having these thoughts about having a real life. And as this happens through the course of the movie here, he gets intermingled with, Sweatshirt Kid by running into him at the skate park while separated from his friends after the graveyard scene.
Yeah.
And Kid knocks his head and he's like, I could have a concussion, so you owe me. And he's just like, well, okay, what? He just walked me home. And the social poison of that.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not going anywhere with you.
Palpable. And it's like, that is so cool that it's worse to him to be seen with this kid than to offer him money or a free shot. He's like, you punch me, one shot. Mm-hmm. The kid's like, I don't want that. Like, walk me home. And that is worse to him. He'd rather get punched in the face than be seen in public with this kid. And that, again, to me, is such a memory of my childhood, where I remember kids being like, inviting the uncool kid over and going like, just don't tell other people I did this.
Hmm.
And it's like, oh, God, we were animals.
I was the uncool kid, so I don't remember doing that at all. Finding a kid one level below the rung from me, and especially in middle school, that would have been
difficult.
The only kids that were a level below were the kids who were a little bit poorer and a little bit more Jesus-y. Even further out into the woods than I was.
Yeah, and I feel like the kids that were below me were usually poorer. I think I being really funny and big enough to be accidentally athletic until everyone else got athletic helped me out a lot, and then rapidly had me ditched as soon as everybody else turned 16. And then it was just like I was now useless to them. But anyway.
Yeah, Charlie, by the way, was just super cool his entire career. I mean, you've always been handsome, athletic, funny. You're son of a bitch.
Yeah. So Duder eventually gets persuaded to...
That scene where they run into each other at the skate park. And I go back to this young man, I would love to see him in a bunch more stuff. Toby Wallace, I guess, is the actor. Because, like, when he sees the hooded sweatshirt guy, like, you can see this constant wrestling that he does with himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes through the whole movie, and it's like, but he really wrestles with himself. Like, do I put on the front? Do I not put on the front? Do I just take a tone? Do I not take a tone? Like, because, I mean, to that point, like, we could assume that these guys have a background before we start to understand it, but it's sort of like, to that point, we don't know from Adam, you know, one way or the other, really. I mean, you could guess, but as he like is wrestling in each one of these scenes, like he really—it's a big struggle that he kind of goes through, whatever else. And to the other young man's credit, that plays Jonah, like that kid's another really good actor, and like he sees it, he sees where to push the buttons, and he sees where to, you know,
he definitely
that's familiarity, that's time, you know, it's like
I think the underdog in these situations sees the blueprints better.
Yeah, for sure.
Of, and it's like how social engineering is working.
But in terms of crafting a movie, like how confident do you have to be to just be like, we're going to rely on the authenticity of the time built into this relationship to make this work? You know, that takes a lot of confidence. And I think all three of us got a pretty strong emotional response from this film. And it's like, you know, it's very admirable to lay it on that part of it. Cause I mean, how many times do we watch, it doesn't have to be horror movies. Like how many times do you watch a lot of stuff where they're like, this is the emotional relationship. And you go, well, okay, if you say so, you know, there's like, you didn't give me anything to tell me that. And here they're like, well, we're going to rest our laurels on that part of it and how complex and deep it really is. And as it goes, my God, as you're going with them, it really does matter. It really is grounded. It really is. You know, has matter, and it's like it starts there. It starts at that scene. You know,
I made Megan watch The Warriors for the first time a couple days ago,
and eventually I'll watch it.
It is so goddamn good, and I still fucking love it. And she was like probably 75% into it. One of her main complaints, though, was that the gal who is trying to provoke the fight between the warriors and the orphans that then becomes the war chief's sort of girl. Is the least motivated character probably in any romantic relationship. And it is, again, like, that's the example that most recently I saw Charlie, I think has the same thing of like, you just tried to get these guys' asses kicked. And now you're suddenly like wicked in love with this guy. But then as soon as he talks to you, you're like, fuck off. And you disappear for a while. And then you pop back up just in time to get him in trouble again. And it's like, what is even happening? it's bonkers. And I was like, yeah, you know, I hadn't like thought about that, but you're right. It is just that part doesn't make sense. And then we had a very long argument about the Lizzies. But, it was fun to watch that again because I hadn't in a little bit. But, oh God, that movie's so good. And one of these days, Josh, we'll sit down and watch it. Anyway, moving on to this movie.
Well, how did the warrior story tie into this movie?
The, relationships that are forced versus.
Okay. Because I felt like there was the first half of a story and then it didn't quite.
That was it. It was just the idea of like having seen an example that was fresh. Yeah.
So this becomes this kind of odyssey for Corey, who is, he needs to first face up to how he's been living, how he's been treating people. He needs to start having some ideas and thinking on his own. And he needs to like make his peace and actually commit to being a better human being. So Jonah is kind of taking him on this voyage by taking him back to when they were kids.
It's very Dante Virgil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Dante Randall even. And they, so when they were kids, they would play a game in the park where they'd like, when we cross this bridge, we're going into the realm of Cocytus where anything is possible and dreams can be real. And this whole like, game of imagination and trying to freak each other out that they used to play when they were kids. So it takes them through being kids and occasionally very subtly flashes back to actual stuff that happened when they were kids, but also, you know, like the, when the dipshit guys come into the high school, they have werewolf shadows for a minute and like werewolf feet for a minute,
which should be terrible, but totally works.
You know, it's because it's that like Del Toro-y
yeah.
kind of heightened reality and magic realism is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Which again, like the idea that a lot of people call this a horror movie, I think it's a coming of age tale with fantasy elements.
Right.
Horror is probably selling it wrong. Cause there are people that won't watch it if they think it's horror. This is a movie you could watch with, I think, anyone, and yeah. they would dig it.
Well, to a point, though, I mean, like, I really want Kristen and Conlon to watch this. I've told them this multiple times that you guys are going to need to watch this because it's a very, very lovely thing. But, I mean, there are parts, like, I mean, Kristen, God love her. She's watched more horror movies the last 7 years than she has in her entire lifetime. thank you. But it's one of those things where, like, I have the Kristen scale, which is like what she can see and not see. And that's not condescending on my part. That's, I know her personality and there's a lot she can't sure. deal with. And she's more game than a lot of people for watching stuff. And I think that there's a few moments in this that are kind of, you know, like not well, the like, thing is, like super
there's
bad
a difference between moments that are but there's a difference between moments that are upsetting and moments that are horror. Cause American History X is extremely upsetting, but it's not a horror movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? I don't mean like that. But like, I think
this
like
is a movie that could very much
the dark
upset
kind of
people.
Stuff. Like, you know, that type of yeah. thing where, you know, the average normal person is going to be watching that and kind of going, you know. So, I mean, it's a weird argument because I've been seeing this recently because with Before I Wake and with some other stuff where it's sort of like, it's not really a horror movie. And it's just like this very like kind of dismissive thing. And I just can't get, it's weird because I get defensive because I kind of get where I'm like, it's like, yeah, fuck off with your stupid rules. But then it's like, but it isn't, it's a lot of gray area, you know? It's like, it's kind of, it's tricky.
Yeah. Well, like, there is the, on the one hand, fuck gatekeeping of any kind.
Yeah. Yes.
But on the other hand, you could say, like, don't go into this expecting It Follows.
Yeah,
don't
I
go
into this expecting it could be misrepresented. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and on the other side too, like if you're not a horror fan, please watch this anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a horror fan, don't go into this expecting that your pants to get scared off because that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. Yeah. And that's the thing.
Yeah,
it's,
sure.
it's more about, you know, quote unquote, like truth in advertising. You know, it's just like setting expectations is all I'm really.
But before
about.
You know, before we know what Jonah's mission is,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
There's this possibility that it could get real dark at any moment.
Yeah.
And it, like going into the tunnel and everything.
There's
heady
danger.
There's
here.
Tension there that it turns out we're going for something a whole lot more subtle than Jonah being evil and leading him to something awful, you know?
But it hints around those edges, don't you think, Joshua? Like, I mean, not like overtly, but I mean, there's a couple moments where I'm like, I wonder what's the deal.
Yeah, like is he trying to scare Corey
well,
or are we going to kill Corey?
He's a little too verbose and astute for a kid that, like, because if you're pissed at your friend, especially at that age, you're probably going to be a little more vulgar.
Uh-huh.
And this kid is, like, professorial about a lot of it. He's spot on. But it's like, it's very considered and measured. And so you're like, you're lecturing. And that's weird.
And it's
so like, but then again, maybe this kid had that much time sitting in his room alone mm-hmm. to think about everything he'd ever say.
And it's a mask, you know, like, though. That's what kills me is there's so much pain in that kid. And that actor gets it across.
Oh, for sure.
There's all this bitterness and pain and it's all behind that mask.
He's doing like some of that like Elijah Wood shit. Mm-hmm. Like, you're just like, woof, like your eyes are too big for a human, and you're able to emote the shit out of them because no one wants shit in their eyes. But
so, go ahead.
The journey, I think, like becomes bigger than literally walking from A to B because it feels like it takes forever.
Start detouring.
Which,
because they want to spend more time together.
Yeah, which is the journey working. This is the hero's journey as well as kind of, well, which I guess, which is Dante and Virgil.
Mm.
God, those scenes are beautiful though, man. Those scenes are just. Oh,
like the scene with the big lit up tree and stuff, like there's some amazingly gorgeous stuff in this movie.
Well, not pretentious. But that's another thing to point out too. There's a scene where they're talking about the dog dying and then like when he like talks about his mom dying and things along those lines. That whole scene. It is not pretentious. And that's the thing that another hats off to these folks that like, it could have very easily just sort of been like, you know, like that was the thing for Family Guy, you know, these feelings matter. Like that kind of bullshit. But it's like, it's just not. It just isn't. It's just no pretension whatsoever. And it's just,
yeah, I don't think there's, man. I don't have an easy answer for why it doesn't feel like this film just kind of crawls up its own ass.
Yeah.
But somehow it doesn't. And again, yeah. I think this may very well be a thing. I would love to hear from folks that are not our age.
Hmm.
That the cultural references become moot.
Hmm.
Does this land? Because I think the emotional heart of it is the same, but I also wonder if, am I riding just enough nostalgia wave that the music is meaning more to me? And like, we've talked more about ourselves personally in this episode than we normally do in 6 months. And that's great and fine. I love that. But like, it's... this clearly hits a certain sweet spot for us. And what if it doesn't for you?
I wonder.
What if you grew up on EDM and all that, and you just don't have... this music sucks to you. You grew up in an era where people were more woke, and you still have your problems, but they're different. Does this speak to you the same? I don't know. But to me, all this is pitched perfectly.
Right.
And I think even if the references are lost, because again, the Breakfast Club references aren't correct for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know of them, but I only know of them. But they work because the heart is there. Although that's more saccharine than this is, which is less, I think.
Yeah, this feels, the emotional core of this feels like it would work for anybody any age. But I think you get more out of it if you've been in those social constructs.
Yeah.
And if you've had that one weird night, or if you're lucky, a bunch of weird nights with people where suddenly the sun is coming up and you're like, holy shit, we went to my friend's housing complex where he lives and climbed over the fence and almost skinny dipped, but then we didn't. But then we went and got on the roof and we went and teepeed somebody's house and like, shit, it's fucking dawn now. You're like, if you're old enough to have had that.
Yeah. And we're old enough now to have some of that in our rear view.
Mm-hmm.
And so that maybe matters to make it more nostalgic.
Because I could relate.
Because it also, this to is that,
like,
that really,
well, this night just keeps getting weirder.
And
you know?
Yeah, and it's like, and I've had those where you're like, I can't believe I am here right now doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And then you still don't go home.
Yeah.
Like, and that's another thing, too, is like, how long is this night? Well, they started while it was light out. They have a long time. And it just keeps going because they don't have any vested interest in being home for bedtime. You know, that's their whole bag.
And he also gets home for a minute.
Yeah.
And then goes out again.
The
vagina.
But speaking of that, we mentioned, I feel really terrible. I can't remember her name.
The girl's
girl who becomes
Romani.
Graveyard
Romani?
Shift girl.
Romani?
Graveyard
Romani?
Girl.
Yeah. But they end up, like, once, what was it? What was our protagonist's name again?
Corey.
Corey. Once Corey and,
Jonah.
Have sort of settled on the fact that they're friends again.
Mm-hmm.
They are, you know, Corey's like, you hungry? And he's like, yeah. And so they head to the graveyard shift girl's place, which is like a weird Walgreens type thing.
Yeah.
Like a drugstore, some minimal grocery, but doesn't appear to be like a gas station, I don't think.
I thought it was a gas station.
Like a 7-Eleven.
Was it a gas station? Circle K. It's just a little convenience store. And so they go in, and then... you're like, oh, what a cool bro-y move. Like, let's go in and get some food and we'll finish our walk home. And then you watch how he still can't quite shed some of the vestiges of what he's been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cut to him and the girl sitting in an aisle. And she's like letting you use some like fucking deodorant. And because he stinks, he's been out all night. And they're snacking on food that she's clearly not making him pay for. And they're just chatting away and talking. And Megan and I both went, where the fuck's Jonah? And he's just hanging outside at the edge of the circle of light because he still isn't allowed to be seen. And you're like, oh, you dick. You know, and then...
But did you not think at that point?
Maybe. But at the same time, you don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes perfect... It's like The Sixth Sense. All this makes perfect sense in retrospect. You know, but it is troubling in that moment where you're like, bro, I thought we were learning and growing together.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and that's when they have the conversation. It is literally being a girl around you boys. No, being a woman around you boys and waiting for you to grow the fuck up so we can actually talk and have relationships and hang out is frustrating as shit.
That is some, you know, real ass shit.
Super
it's amazing.
Heavy science she drops on him, and every single word is fucking truth.
But that's also when bro boys pop up
and
again.
And then, yeah, Hitler Youth and the rest of the guys show up, and they have their first, like, full-on, I'm no longer part of the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And then escape to, you know, get out, and he and Jonah, I forget where they go after that. Do they just bolt into the woods?
You know, the best way to keep the wolves away from your house is to go to their house, and then, like, they go kind of mess up the Django's house, which is kind of an entertaining little bit of thing.
It's a good bonding moment.
And then they get the thing where he goes over to they go over to Romani's house where they have that wonderful scene where she she's taking off her makeup and stuff, and it's a really neat little scene. Like, it's not like there's nothing titillating about it. There's nothing kind of no part of that anything. It's just like she's just this like normal everyday person. And there's just something really cool and grounded about that. And then he shows up and does the maneuver with the fire extinguisher in the snow. Huh.
And we get our Romeo and Juliet balcony scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is just sort of like, so delightful.
Which is probably the most heavy-handed idea in the movie, but it's very charming. Like, I the movie had way, way more than enough credit for me to be like, all right.
it's super cute.
Yeah.
It is a scene that could be almost lifted intact and put in a more like a Can't Hardly Wait
absolutely
kind of movie, which is a more heightened version of it.
Yeah,
but it's also clumsy enough that I think it works.
He's still bad at everything.
Yeah, he falls all over himself and
he's terrible
and abandons Jonah again for an extended period of time.
Dude, every time, like,
but then that leads to the Dia de los Muertos.
Well, but we also don't know. No, yeah, I want to get to that. I want to get to that part.
But like, pretty sure what's up with Jonah.
Yeah.
You know, those two scenes, the convenience store and then over at her house, like, you know, we don't know necessarily what conversation they had walking over. And he's like, oh, I really like her. And I kind of fucked up earlier in this or whatever. And he's like, no, you should go. And like, so I could almost foresee a situation where it could have been a compromise maybe. You know,
oh, dude, I have personally spent plenty of time walking in circles in a parking lot while my friend fucked his girlfriend in my car. And friends have done that for me. Like, you know, my buddy Eddie, back in the day, we went to Edgefest, probably, in Wisconsin. And it was me, my girlfriend, and him that took his little station wagon over. And so we didn't have the money for a campsite. So we just drove a couple miles out of town, found a dirt road that seemed relatively abandoned, pulled off onto a little side dirt road. And we're like, okay, we'll just sleep here. And we're all sitting outside of the car drinking. And then Race and I head into the truck, and Eddie just goes, I'm just having another cigarette before bed. And then he, you know, after we're done having sex, just look at an appropriate amount of time, he comes in, sleeps in the front seat, we sleep in the back. And the next morning, the concert was like, hey, bro, thanks for being cool. He's like, no, I just sat there and smoked cigarettes, thought about music, listened to the gentle swish swish of my gas tank.
Yeah.
That is one of the fact that I can remember that means it is one of the most poetic things I've ever heard.
That's what it means to be gentle, is what you're saying.
but it's just like that is shit you do, you know, at that age, especially because opportunities for such things are few and far between. And so it's like, yeah, you're right. That could have been a thing of like, bro, I'm going to talk to this girl. You cool? Wait. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, I will. I've done that a lot of times. And
in this circumstance, it was likely Jonah
going.
This is not
going, the night to do this, bro. Like,
yeah, but I could see Jonah
being the
knowing that this is his night, so yeah. Get up there and go talk to her.
Well, he's trying to get him better, and she's someone that's trying to make him a better person.
Mm-hmm. So then there's a moment that happens right after that just legitimately, like, I thought was really scary, was the thing where he comes down from the balcony, you know, and he comes down from the balcony and he can't find Jonah. He looks down the street and it's like he sees his dog, and it's like immediately in my head it goes. Oh shit, that's his dog. And he goes, Rex? I was like, and I just goosebumps. I was like, fuck. Like, God damn it. Now's where we go dark. And it's like, and he starts following the dog. Like, they don't follow the fucking dog. What are you doing? And he's following the dog. And then you get that scene, the Los Muertos, that kind of, and the woman singing and stuff. And I'm like, oh my God. Unbelievable. It's so incredible and just, oh man, that flew me on my ass, that scene.
Because in addition to the, you know, the acting and the story in this is amazing, the cinematography and the look of this is unfucking believable.
Yeah, man. It's shot so good.
All shot at night, but it's so sharp.
It's always
and
yeah,
crisp,
lit perfectly.
And the colors pop, and especially in Dia de los Muertos, you got the orange flowers and everything. And
which, again, that was also, it's just fascinating that that was where they chose to go.
Because
as we're watching it, we started chatting, going like, we're in Australia. What the fuck, right? And I'm like, well, this is like clearly the most visual way to convey something like this. And we're like, but is that weird? I'm like, well, if you think about it, like Japanese stuff will use a ton of like Christian iconography because they don't care.
Right.
It's the same as us using Zeus. Like, it's just, it's not a thing that matters. So I'm like, yeah, like, I don't want to care about what people might think is troubling about this because I don't think it's done with any kind of ill intention. I think it's done with the idea of like, we're trying to convey some heavy shit. And I understand if people are upset by whatever the fact that like these people obviously don't give a shit about Dia de los Muertos because they're in Australia. But.
Or maybe, you know, maybe there's a Spanish population there. Maybe, like Spain and
England
are pretty close together.
I'm sure there must be some spots like that. But it's just like, I can see that being like the first complaint people would have about that scene. And I'm like, fuck you. It's awesome.
Yeah. And it's like, entirely it's in not, keeping it, with it, the spirit of the holiday.
Yeah. And it,
too.
Yeah. And it also doesn't feel. And maybe this is just honky speak, but like it doesn't feel sneering in any way. It doesn't feel like
no,
like I'm putting on a sugar face.
yeah,
but like it doesn't. It just feels sincere, and it feels like it doesn't feel out of place. I guess
no, it's. I think that is one of the major emotional beats of the film.
And it's just like, and it's so haunting too. And it's just, it's unnerving. It's pretty, you know, but it's unnerving for sure, you know.
What I think is so important about that though is that like, what other option is there that would make it feel the same? You know, like what do? You put a bunch of people lighting tea lights like you would if you're Catholic? That's not nearly as evocative. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to show all the emotion that's swirling around here and also let us know, like what better metaphor for that is this, which I think is simply respecting that this aspect of one culture is doing this very well,
yeah.
Which I think only glorifies that culture, you know? And so,
oh yeah, I can't imagine
the, amazing, but yeah. Like,
can't imagine.
I don't get to have an opinion.
People will get pissed off about
it. Yeah, but it is, to me, that is super powerful. And that is where we get the a cappella cover of a song that we suddenly realize is live.
Yeah, as soon as that.
Hauntingly beautiful.
They play two chords on the guitar. I go, that sounds like lightning crashes. And then all of the death man in the white suit starts singing it. And I go, okay, I'll take it.
It's so good.
So here's a cool thing, though.
First cool thing.
So many cool things, but one cool thing is in the beginning in Corey's room, we see a poster, not for the Crow, but for City of Angels.
I argued about that a lot.
Right? And when we see Jonah, he has got the Harlequin mask and he's got the dark circles around his eyes. Not quite Crow makeup, but close.
Similar, yeah.
They throw a crow at his window.
Oh,
the bird they throw at his window is a crow.
Oh.
Crow City of Angels is all about Dia de los Muertos imagery and those orange flowers and everything. And it's about a guy who comes back from the dead for one night so that he can set things right.
Oh my gosh.
And none
Josh,
of that.
Read an IMDb trivia moment.
None of that is punching you in the face.
No, I swear to God, it's all there.
My only complaint was that it was Crow City of Angels and not the original.
No, I think it was on purpose.
No, I'm sure it is.
So that it
that was another thing that, like, after arguing about The Warriors, Megan and I argued about why it wasn't the better Crow movie. Because while Iggy Pop is in The Crow City of Angels, it is not as good of a movie.
Was she arguing
more sodium lighting?
Was she arguing that the original Crow was not as good as City of Angels?
No, that it was okay to have that one.
Oh, see, it's okay because that's...
For the era.
If that is intended, that is fucking brilliant.
It is absolutely brilliant, yeah.
Well, but then also, too, like, two things with that is, one is, rewind them back to being a little younger, and the first time they would see the iconography of the Crow movies and being like, oh my god, I could just see, like, 13, 14-year-old boys just losing their shit for a month, like, just talking about
it. I can tell
you
I did.
Thing, like, that feels authentic, and then also... Like, again, going back to what I said a while ago, which was how many different ways could they have fucked this up? Like, it could have been one of those things like Jonah is wronged and this, that, whatever else. And he was dead and he's going to come back and fuck with all these people. Like, is that interesting? Not particularly. Like, there's not a lot there, you know, but it's like, oh, well, it turns out he had died and then he's going to come back for, you know, he's going to exact vengeance. Well, we've all seen about 100 slasher movies that all have that set up, but like, this is not that story. And it's just like, isn't that cool to kind of see how that fits together? I got to say, Joshua, I didn't think about any of that stuff that you mentioned about on that part of it. That's really cool.
That is perhaps really neat. The biggest revelation we've ever had on the show.
Nice. Like, super cool.
Fuck. That's
because that's
good.
Subtle and it's clever.
And it's spot on.
So at the very beginning, when Jonah drops the bottle and then he's at the skate park, I was like, I kind of wonder if he's dead. And when he says, I have something to show you that will blow your mind, very early on, I was like, kind of thinking he's dead. But it wasn't, as the movie went on, it wasn't that like, oh God, he's fucking dead, whatever. Because the whole movie didn't hinge on it.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't.
It was our hero's journey for Corey.
And it wasn't really trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's just, we'll get there. Mm-hmm. And so to me, that was just like that revelation with that poor tiny body face down in the water is just...
Oh my God, that's the scene that
like
got me.
It's like Elliot from E.T. drowning.
It just feels... It doesn't feel like, what a twist. It feels inevitable and sad, and it has this real ramifications for all of the characters, including Django, who then gets to decide whether or not he's going to have feelings or not, and he lets himself, and he gets some shot at redemption too.
Yeah.
Like he's, and you see, also like just kind of going off that, Django gets several points at which you get to see behind his front too. Mm-hmm. And he's not just the scary dickhead kid. Cause you see some moments where he's like genuinely afraid he's losing his friend, genuinely afraid he's losing control.
Well, and genuinely
of his friend, his group.
Anything will change.
Yeah.
Which is also, I think, completely related.
And then also just super pissed at life and not able to express it in any
way. Yeah.
Just the impotence of small town life and the fear, which, because you're young, turns to rage.
Right.
Of, but I've got all my best friends right here, right now. We do everything we've ever wanted. Why would we ever change that?
Yeah. What was it? Weed to smoke, bitches to fuck,
and fags to bash.
Yeah.
That was their whole life. And it's just like, and when Corey repeats that to Graveyard Shift, she's just like, you fucking child. And just leaves. And, you know, and yet when, Hitler Youth says it, like, it's a rallying cry, basically. Mm. And then you watch him realize that, like, oh shit, that might not be enough anymore.
Mm-hmm.
For people, I will be left behind. You know, and suddenly, what he is, without probably realizing the full extent of it, he's realizing he will become Al Bundy. He will be the guy at the bar
who peaked in high school.
That peaked in high school with glory days that no one gives a shit about. And it's like, whoa. Like, as much as he's a complete asshole, like, you also see that it's not like it's going to end well for him if he doesn't change either. So, yeah, it's impressive. So, yeah, and again, this is the thing that, I think it was Werewolf Ambulance did Sixth Sense recently and brought this idea up, that the idea that Jonah is dead being a twist is kind of a misnomer, in the same way that Bruce Willis being dead as a twist might be a misnomer. And it's more of a revelation, because everything still makes sense. And this is the thing that goes back to our old argument. But it's an interesting way to think of it, which I find a level of finesse that had never occurred to me, is that it informs the film, but you don't have to be surprised and go, oh, it was the butler the whole time with no reason to think so.
Yeah.
It's just like, no, we were just given more information that logically follows from what we've seen. And that is very interesting. And that kind of makes me question some of the movies we've seen that have a quote-unquote twist ending. And so I think, like the revelation that Jonah's dead adds weight to what he's saying, but it doesn't mean that anything has really changed in their interaction.
That's the thing. Like, even more so than The Sixth Sense, it doesn't make you reevaluate the whole film.
No.
Because that's not the central thrust of the film.
Right.
Which is, I kind of feel the same way about Fight Club, but I won't go down that rabbit hole. Whatever. But, that's...
Which so, I think, honestly, that's a lighter touch and a smarter touch, which mm-hmm. I'm applauding in this situation. Yeah.
Because the movie isn't about Jonah being dead, which is great. And it could have been. Mm-hmm. It's about this journey that the two kids take together.
Well, and on many levels, it would work if he wasn't.
Yeah.
You'd lose a little bit of opportunity for perhaps Hitler Youth to change at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also write a different scene where he has a reason to. But it could just be someone learning to be friends again with someone despite societal pressures. And that's hard enough.
And give this movie so much credit that how bought in I was that as they just kept piling on the evidence that this is the road we're going down, I kept going, yeah, but I kind of hope that he's not. I kind of hope that in Cocytus it seems like he is, but that Corey can bring him back.
Yeah.
And
maybe he's being led there to save him.
It's probably it's a way fucking better movie that they don't do that because that's what I wanted, but not what I needed out of it.
Mm.
But that the end of that just punches like a motherfucker.
It's so good.
And they even earn that ending, the like mega happy ending where Corey and Graveyard Girl both get what they want.
They Skype each other or whatever.
She's in Canada and they're living their dream.
But it's separate, which I like that they're both doing their thing and they're doing it separately. I still feel like they had so much emotional punch off the previous thing. I kind of didn't want to see
that. You didn't need that coda.
I would have assumed it.
But I really liked
too much
in his apartment that he has the giant poster of the picture that he took.
Agreed.
Which is like his most shameful moment, but also
it's a very humbling thing.
This reminder of this kid that, you know, and that meant a lot to me to see that.
I did like that. Yeah.
Anything else you got there, Charlie?
Oh, I just, this is a neat thing in general. I think, if they're going to make the movie that bully kid loses his shit and he's the one who kills Jonah, that's that movie. If it's going to be Jonah Ghost comes back to wreak vengeance on the people who bullied him into death, that's that movie. But this is a very different kind of animal. And I think this, not to be too snide about it, but this is harder to do. You know, and I'm a softie for sure, but when he's screaming in the ravine with holding Jonah's body, and I was just like, just, you know, all teary faced with the whole thing. And then when he's sitting with his dad and he starts crying again, I was like, God damn, man. Like I really, you know, what he has learned and the impact on his life is very profound for sure. But I also just like, God damn it. Why couldn't he have his friend too? It's like, man, you know, but I don't know. There's something kind of neat about stuff like this. And they don't necessarily have to be supernatural things. They can be all kinds of different stuff. They can be albums. They can be art. They can be performance. They can be all kinds of stuff. But like, this takes a level of like committedness that I think is really neat. And so I would really love to see what this fellow will do after this. In addition to the actors in this thing, all of them I really liked, especially the two, all of them really. They all were good.
Yeah. Well, the two we're supposed to like, or three that we're supposed to like, I mm-hmm. very much liked. But the folks that we hated were doing such a good job that we hated them. That's always a hard part to remind myself in movies. It's like,
well, it's an interesting thing too, because
like, oh, he's supposed to.
You could really get into cheeseball territory. Like when they're in the tree, for example. Like that was just sort of like, that was a prime moment for it to be like, do whatever, you know. But it just doesn't. You know, it just doesn't. And that's indicative of the movie as a whole. And so I just think I just thought it was lovely. I really liked it a lot.
And there could, especially the moment in the tree, that's the Del Toro that if you don't have his instincts is like razor sharp to walk that line, it would get stupid. Cause like they're climbing the tree and they've got clocks running backwards stuck in the tree and toys stuck in the tree and they're going back and forth between adult and kid versions of themselves. And it could be just super literal and dumb.
Yeah.
And I think, you actually get a little bit of that in Before I Wake, but we'll get there to where they don't quite get it. And Mama had the same thing.
Yeah.
Where like, we're doing the Del Toro thing, but we don't quite have the soft enough touch. But this did. I mean, for me, this was kind of a miraculous little thing. And it pissed me off that I hadn't heard of it.
Yeah.
That like, how come this didn't get a big push, like a nice prestige push?
Cause I already pimped it to somebody at work today.
Fucking amazing. Like, acting is great. The story is great. It's so heartfelt and gets so many things right. It's beautiful to look at.
Yeah,
just constantly throwing gorgeous scenes in. You know, the riding the bikes down the street with the fireworks going off on either side. That kind of shit. Yeah. It's gorgeous throughout. This for me is at least a 9 out of 10. One of the best movies I've seen in a couple of years, I think. 9 out of 10 Australian Stiflers.
Nice. Yeah, it's funny. You know, I feel like this is a long movie, by the way, too. It doesn't feel it, but it is a very long movie. Mm-hmm. But that meant, like, when watching it with Megan, we had time to chat as we're going along, which was part of where suddenly we were going, oh, no. Oh, I don't think Jonah's alive. You know, and then yeah. We had time to actually, like, in real time, debate that back and forth. And like I said, debate why he has the shittier Crow movie poster and not the better one. Like, little things like that. And, like, I feel like if you were sitting on the couch next to the two of us as we watched this, you might have heard me complain more, and she might also think that that was where I was at. And so this may, again, be part of that effect of when the three of us talk about a movie, and especially as we identify more with it, as I certainly did, which is a thing that she and I also talked about a lot after the film. Because this is one, like, we just, like, it got done, and we just talked while we made dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really great for that, which is, I always love that when a movie does that for you. And so it's like, I feel like I had some things where I was like, oh, this or that or whatever, but they all, the, you know, once you get like a day or two away from it, seems so trifling compared to like the way I feel when I think about it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I feel like it's, you know, we've said it all, like the actors are great, especially I would say, our two leads,
mm-hmm.
Corey especially manages to be completely smarmy as a bully, completely conflicted when he's in between, and completely vulnerable when he's crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe all three. And that is very hard for, especially a younger dude to pull off, but he fucking nails it. Yeah, like all the actors are all great. The look of it is fucking gorgeous. And again, as we said, so much of this is shot at night. The fact that you're never squinting and leaning forward going, what the fuck am I supposed to be looking at? Like, that never happens. And then, this just hit, and it could be unique to me. Like I said, like that so much of my childhood is wrapped up in this movie, but it just seems like such universal experiences. So even if the language changes, the message is the same.
Mm.
And that is just such an achievement. So, yeah, I'm gonna be right there with you, Josh. I'm gonna say it's a 9 out of 10. Far more mature women your age, reminding you to act your age.
Mm.
I love her little outburst. I think that's so good. Such
it's
a human,
so
such
good,
a great, human little moment. She's just like, I love that. It's great. Very authentic. Yeah, I think this is super, super cool. And to Josh's point about, you know, not hearing around on it, this was one of those ones. I actually had it. They screened this in Austin, and I couldn't go for some reason. I think there was something with Conan that something was going on. I couldn't go. But it was just like, it was one of those ones you expect. Oh yeah, it'll come out for sure. Yeah, it'll be. Yeah. Like, no. And it just sort of, so I mean, it's a bummer for sure. Although my hope is that maybe it got a better reception down in Australia, hopefully. But in any event, so I'm kind of in the same spot. So I would say, I'd say 9 out of 10 fun sucking butt straws.
Wow.
Because, God, okay. I love that line. Oh, man, I love
it's
that
line. It's a good
line. When exactly did someone stick a straw up your ass and suck out all the fun? Oh, so good.
It's pretty good.
If someone did that to the fun-loving criminals, would they no longer be loving fun?
Hmm.
See, now I have – not Josh, I have the thing where it's like, la-di-da-di, Gotti.
Is it better to have loved fun and lost it than never loved fun at all?
What kind of snacks
size,
do they eat now?
Depends on the size of the straw, I think.
I mean, I liked them back when they were the format, too. I'm just saying. Bam.
Deep cut.
Anybody want a break?
I would actually like to, yeah.
Yeah,
well, take a little break, and we'll be back with the Volt. So up next, we have the Vault, or El Sótano, which
that's a fun one.
Sotano feature, which is just the basement, but you know, it's the basement under the bank. That's where the vault is. I figure it was justified. Mm. This one's got James Franco for no particular reason. It's hard to see like what would have drawn him to this script or this role.
He likes doing weird stuff,
right? But this isn't as weird as all that, you know.
No.
So it's a little, I don't know, I strange.
I think he's a douche. So I was like, I watched this despite him being in it. Although he does a great job.
Yeah, he has very little to do and he does it well. I was more distracted by Taryn Manning.
Who's Taryn Manning?
She's the...
is she the gal from Orange is the New Black?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She enraged me this entire movie. Yeah.
She's a little distracting, yeah, because she can't just be people.
The other thing that was weird with this one, too, is... the lead that starts out as blonde and then becomes not blonde, yeah, her.
Right.
Francesca Eastwood, who is Clint Eastwood's daughter or granddaughter or something like that. Apparently she got hitched to Clifton Collins, who's like 25 years older than her.
Oh.
Because she is 23 and he's like 48. I was like, oh.
That's just
so I read that right before I started the movie. Like, I was looking at the thing, I was like, oh. All right. Which I hate knowing that drives me nuts. I hate that, but it's like,
well, the real life shit intruding on a movie is always a drag. Like I said, like as a guy that doesn't like James Franco, because like I've listened to like him being on WTF with Marc Maron at a live show, even more, and just kind of being a dick and not even answering the questions and just being like, I'm done. And you're like, what a prick you are to go on someone else's show and embarrass them in front of a live audience. Like, good job, but like. I don't know. I've got my issue with that. And then a lot of the things he does with like Seth Rogen and stuff, I find just completely talentless. But, so the gist of this movie though is you've got a group of people are going to go rob a bank. The bank is haunted, sort of. And then you find out that, well, if you go in the basement, it's super haunted. And of course, when there's not enough money in the regular bank, they're told by the bank manager to go downstairs to the big vault that has more money in it. And then that's where all the ghosts are. Mm. And then people start getting picked up by the ghosts. And then the cops are outside, so there's a lot of tension. And then...
theoretically.
Yeah, these are the dumb... just as a quick aside, these are the dumb fucking-ass criminals.
They're the worst.
It's like, you're down in the basement. Criminals. That's where all the money's kept. That's where we have all the money. And it's just like, okay. Yeah. Like, go down in the basement where I have all the money. That's the extra money area. It's like, man, well, what
there's
the
a vault in the basement that no one will go to, but it has $6 million in it. Mm-hmm. And they're like, sounds good.
Seems just, legitimate. Yeah. I trust you implicitly. Because
it's like, when they're like, they break in, none of the cops are there yet. No alarms have been set. They figure out they've got, what was it, like $200,000 in cash?
I think it was only like $70,000 or something. And they needed $500,000 for Brothers for operation or whatever.
Whatever it is. But like whatever they've gotten, they can get away with scot-free because clearly at this point, zero people know about it. And they're like, we're not leaving until we get the money. I'm like, that's not how bank robberies work.
Yeah,
like, you don't hang out longer. Cause you know how all those times when you see on the news, oh, there's a bunch of bank robbers holed up in the bank with hostages. And then they're like, what happened? Well, they asked for a helicopter. So we gave them one and they got away.
Yeah.
But that has literally never happened in the history of time.
Yeah. Right.
So like you just, that's not what works. You go, fuck, we're fucked. Time to go rob another bank.
Mm-hmm.
And you leave that bank.
Or maybe just set up a GoFundMe. I mean,
you know, well, yeah, but I mean, that is just, I think that is meant to set them up as fucking idiots.
Yeah.
Because they clearly are. And this leads into one of my big complaints with this movie is that like, it's sister, brother, right? Because isn't Praying Mantis Woman supposed to be the sister of Orange is the New Black woman who are related to brother who doesn't want to hurt anybody?
Right.
And notes, I call him Old Man Fingers.
Okay, yeah. And somehow, throughout this movie, I'm supposed to care about that.
And there's also giant chubby dude and welder dude.
Giant white supremacist dude.
Yeah.
Which never comes into play, but he has the... shaved head and the tattoo that just says white over his ear.
Right.
Which I can't imagine means anything but that. So, and that's fine. Like, it doesn't really matter. But
maybe
it's just like,
over his other ear, it says stripes, and we never saw that side of him.
Shit, dude. He's just a wicked indie rocker. Yeah. But the whole thing is, there's so much of this movie is spent talking about how this sister's a douche, that sister's a douche, our brother wants this, we need to help our brother. Well, mom, and it's just like, I don't give a fuck about any of this. Because one, they never explain it properly. It's never, we just are told they don't like each other.
There's zero way to any of that.
Yeah, and then it's like they all hate each other, they're all very shrill, and then yet they're all there working together, but hating each other, but working together, but hating each other, and you're like, stop! Because they keep cutting back to some combination of the three of them yelling at each other, and then the movie can start again.
Because in a movie that's just a heist movie, that would be a decent way to ratchet up the tension, to have the characters have an internal conflict.
But you have to give them
But one. You also have a ghost movie going on. In the middle of this.
Which is enough.
Which is way more interesting.
Because every time they're arguing about family dynamics, I'm not seeing a ghost.
Yeah, that is time that could be freaky things with the bags on their heads. Because that shit is pretty good.
They look really good.
I kept thinking, though, of Last Shift.
Megan brought it up like
much
7 times.
Better Last Shift.
And we
is.
Both kept saying Last Shift is so much better.
This is like the shittier version. Because in Last Shift, there's an internal conflict that ties directly into her decision to stay in the station and drives the plot forward.
Well, and also too, like let's take the bank heist ghost bit as the setup, and then we have these god awful characters. So you have this setup, which is kind of it's interesting in its way, I guess. As far as that part of the setup goes, there's nothing wrong there. Better would this have been had it have been, like you said, last shift, or I was thinking of the three kids from Don't Breathe, where like, you know, you have kind of dirtbag guy, but he still has, there's a softness to him. Then you have like Boy Scout kid, and then you have the blonde girl, and it's like, they are 50 times more interesting than this bunch. And it's just sort of like, so you take a haunted bank situation, like, take the characters from Don't Breathe. Yeah. Put them in
also,
there, Pete's sakes.
What the fuck is the point of the cop character played by the dude from Boondock Saints 2 and one of the vegan police in Scott Pilgrim?
Clinton Hellbenders. Yeah. And yeah.
Thank you. I can't remember his name. Who is in the bank while they are beginning the robbery because Orange is the New Black is being as trashy as possible and arguing with the teller. And Praying Mantis Woman is interviewing to get a job at the bank with porn mustache James Franco.
Right.
And he's in there awkwardly hitting on a teller and then leaves. And his partner's just like, how'd that line work for you? And it's like, I assumed he was the inside man.
That was the thing. Yes.
And turns out, nope. That was just an inexplicable and pointless coincidence. Because then when the cops actually show up, he's the guy with the megaphone out front. And I was like, what are you even?
Yeah.
Movie.
Why?
That you literally just pissed in my cereal. And I know I'm using literally wrong, but so is this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, what the fuck is that about? It does nothing.
And also too, in terms of, I wanted to point out one other thing. The girl that plays the lead teller, I can't ever figure out how to pronounce her name properly. It's like, Karanka Kilcher, Karanaka Kilcher.
Yeah,
she was in this
sure
movie
either.
Called Princess Kalani that came out a few years ago. She's amazing in that movie. Go watch.
Well, she's
that
given
movie.
Nothing to do here.
But yeah, that's the thing is she's given these emotional moments. She does a great job. She's a really good actor. That young lady is very talented. But what the hell are you doing in this thing?
To do is whimper and wilt. So
yeah, but and that's the thing. It's like God damn it, that girl can act. She's really talented. And I was just like, well, God damn it. Why the fuck?
Yeah.
What are you doing? Like, who'd you lose a bet to? Like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
Like, she's legit talented. Like, damn it.
So I'm somewhere on the spectrum between not caring and hating our bank robbers. The tellers and like one or two customers are pretty much quickly just black bagged and stuck in a room. And then there's the whole, like, oh, we got to find more money. And the bank manager, porn mustache James Franco, tells him, well, go to the extra safe in the basement. And that's after Praying Mantis Gal has had the interview where he's just like, just need to know. Like, people get upset sometimes. The place could be haunted. There's see things in the basement. And then, like, the teller lady tells, like, even security won't go down there.
Mm-hmm.
We do see manifestations of ghosts on the first floor multiple times in this movie.
James Franco being one of them.
Being one of the main ones, but also malicious ones.
Yeah.
In the room with people. Yeah. Like so it's like the movie breaks its own rules repeatedly.
Well, and give him some credit, though. I will give him some credit. The scene where the White Stripes fan guy has got everybody with the bags in their heads, and she's like, count the people with the thing. And he's looking at the bunch, and he looks down the thing. She says, yeah, you got to count them. He looks back, and it's like there's one more person in there. Like, oh.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
That's it reminded me of the creepypasta. Is it Anansi's goat story or something like that? But there's a thing with, like, there's something wrong where there's these kids that will just insinuate themselves into groups that aren't human. Hmm. And it's like, so these kids keep counting how many people are with them, and the number is different every time. And it reminded me of that. Horror Story Hot Dog coming back soon. Stay tuned. But that is a great scene. But it also is like, well, okay, if these fully malicious hooded ghosts can just pop up into the room where, like, these people take their lunch break, no one can work in this bank.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they're only activated by people being angry. Guess where people are the angriest in life?
Maybe it's only
where they deal with their money.
When somebody is robbing a bank and taking hostages.
Which would make some sense, except that the James Franco ghost is somehow able to set up a job interview with Praying Mantis Woman.
Well, he's not the one doing the job interview.
That was the manager guy. That was a different guy.
Oh, yeah. Different guy. You're right.
Because I thought that for a second.
You know,
too.
It's she pulls him in and he's the other manager. You're right. Fuck. Okay.
So he's from the 80s, which makes the mustache make sense.
I know, which I thought was great once you realize what's happening.
And that's slightly clever.
He has that look. Yeah, that I actually was like, okay, movie well played. Because I was making fun of it until the reveal and I was like, all right.
But then when that reveal happens, you're like, well, okay. And that adds
and you have
or
a ton
subtracts
of stuff
nothing
where
from
you're,
the movie.
No.
Nothing.
You have a ton of moments where you're listening to calls into or out of the bank,
mm-hmm.
like 911 calls or police calling in, and some of them are real time, some of them are calls from the 80s that are being used to help get, and it's like, it's very confusing till the very end which ones are which, and that to me isn't worth it.
No.
It doesn't pay off in a way that I care about. Again, bunch of ghosts with, like, you know, money bag hoods on that are all sunken in for their eyes and shit in the basement. Creepy as shit. Fucking dope. That's rad. And then there's some movie and it's over. Is kind of my impression of this film. Like, is this much as I have to give about this? Like, I like the idea. I think the ghosts are great. Some people breaking into a bank and finding out, like, there's some shit that's fucked. But we keep going to this shitty family disagreement and this weird incompetent police relationship outside.
It's a room temperature mayonnaise sandwich.
It'd be better if this was a thing where they broke in at night and were cat burglars and are dealing with this shit. You know,
and they were cats. 10,000 cats.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're like, all of Ulthar will be mine.
It's like, I've got Cat Stevens. I've got
Cat Denning. Cats.
Yeah.
Man, catamaran. I got a catamaran.
Yeah, I got a catamaran. Bob, we're never going to get that in the truck.
The famous cat jazz musician Cat Calloway.
Catman Brothers.
Don Gatto.
Going back to the Last Shift thing again, like, again, thinking about, like, keeping limited scope or whatever else and how effective so much of Last Shift is, like, it is possible to do a haunted house story. Like, you can keep, people can make them, you know, like, it's possible. And
hope you could still make haunted house movies.
Yeah, but it just makes you think, like, okay, well, we know that it's possible. So then what happened here? And, like, I have no idea except for, and again, I don't know this from Adam, but there's a lot of people credited on this. And if you're all right there, Chief?
I think Josh might be dying. I'll have a haunted house soon.
Oh, I thought that was you, Matthew.
Nope. No, I'm gorgeous.
Yeah, you are.
Because one thing Josh likes above all the things is if he's coughing, for you to ask, are you okay? That's one of his favorite things.
The one time you can't respond?
I have the dumbest epiglottis in the world, which is the little flap that decides whether you're going to send something to the lungs or to the stomach.
Thank you for explaining to me, like, I am also dumb.
Yeah. Well, you looked nonplussed, and I was like, well, let me plus you, motherfucker.
I mean,
you seem like a dude who needed some plussing. That's all I'm saying.
Nonplussed means unimpressed.
No.
Yes.
No.
Currently, people think it means that you're like overly like bleh, or the vice versa. Sorry, yeah, I'm doing backwards. The current version of nonplussed. Yeah, which is I don't care. I know what you're talking about. Move on.
The dilemma that I have.
Sorry,
though,
I fucked up my Dennis Miller moment.
Yeah. It's like, well, technically.
The dilemma that I have is like, if I have water go down the wrong pipe and I'm coughing wherever else, then I almost immediately get the giggles. Cause what happens is I have this little audio clip that plays in my head, which is Josh going, I have a spastic epiglottis.
Yeah.
And it's just like, God damn it. Like, because I still can't breathe and now I'm laughing. God.
So what happens is sometimes.
This is all very upsetting.
I swallow wrong and start coughing. And all that needs to happen is I need to cough until shit calms down. Mm-hmm. And that usually takes like 2 minutes.
Right.
But generally you get like every single motherfucker in the room coming over like, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? And it's just like, fuck off. I can't talk, but I'm breathing clearly. And this is super embarrassing anyway. And nothing you can do is going to make it stop.
Well, I was going to say, next question would be, have you ever asked one of these people, what would you have done if I said, no, I'm not okay? Because the answer is they don't know.
Right.
So, like, that would be a way to turn the embarrassment on them.
Are you going to
be like, have
me?
You, what are you? Yeah, exactly. Because I'm not joking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you, what exactly, what will you offer as help? And be like, yeah, think before you speak.
Quick, put a cigarette up his butt. I read it on the internet.
Enjoy
that pleasant diversion.
The production company thing, like seeing all the how many producers, how many other kinds of things, like I don't like the kind of smarmy armchair, you know, how people got something made because it's a goddamn miracle any movie ever gets made ever. And so it's like, I don't want to be that guy. But like, think about another example of a movie that had a gazillion producers. And I was thinking of Turbo Kid. And in Turbo Kid, like, they had a gazillion producers. They scraped from every nook and cranny and had so much passion, so much excitement, and so much joy and creativity in what they were doing. They made this beautiful, remarkable piece of work. And that was the end result. And how wonderful was that? And so in this situation, like, they wanted to do a haunted house movie in a bank. Like, that's cool. But like, was there a direction to really bring home a very grounded human interest story or like just a balls out fucking scary thing? Like, I don't feel like there's like a rudderless ship kind of situation. And so like, I can't be super mad at it because I just feel like that's your falling point is that, you know, it's they got enough talent around. It just seems like they got no direction.
But it's hard to imagine somebody being super excited about this. Like, maybe the script was super awesome and it just got watered down in production, but it's impossible for me to imagine. Like, it's like if you met someone who is a huge fan of the Gin Blossoms, who'd follow them around for years, like, I mean, they're okay, but why would, to inspire that kind of frenzy, you know, like to have this be something that is willed into existence by 50 some odd people is baffling. Like, what was driving it? Cause it doesn't seem like you said, well, passion was.
The thing is, it has a long list of, production companies, which, you know, like you said, Charlie, like Turbo Kid, there was an Irish flick we watched recently that we commented on how, like, they Dark must song. Have asked, yeah, they asked, like, literally everybody and their grandmas to get money. And I think that is often a sign of, like, okay, someone busted their ass to get this made.
Yeah, absolutely.
I usually consider that a positive. What I normally consider a sign to worry is if there's a huge list of writers.
Yeah.
Because then you don't get, because in general, I would prefer like one or two people with a strong vision. And this only credits on Wikipedia at least two writers. So I think these are just Gin Blossoms fans. Mm. Like, they must have just kind of gotten what they wanted and were good enough to get people on board, you know. I guess. And like, that's fine. Like, somehow, you know, like Dave Matthews Band still sells out stadiums, dude. Like, I don't know. Like, it's not my flavor, whatever. But like, that is a thing. Like, this must have been exactly what somebody was intending in some level. Somebody wanted to write the movie they wrote because they didn't hire a bajillion other people to rewrite it. Somebody wanted to direct this because I don't see anything about like five different directors being brought on. And they had capable enough producers to get enough production companies to spend money on it. Somewhere along the line, everybody was satisfied enough or at least pot committed enough to keep going. Yeah. And again, like you said, Charlie, it's a goddamn miracle any movie gets made. I guess they're just making a movie for someone that's not me. And I, to me, they're just making a bad movie.
And to me, it's for, like, for whom?
I don't for know who that is. It, sir? I don't know what who you're serving with this.
It's although not that does thrilling make me, enough when you for said a thriller.
Band, it makes me think of, if y'all haven't watched Marc Maron's newest special on things on Netflix.
No, not yet.
You have to watch it. It is oh, I love wonderful. Maron. Yeah. But he has this bit about Dave Matthews that's really great and really gave me a lot of joy. And then he has this thing about going to see the Rolling Stones with a buddy of his that's like, oh, that's me now. And my middle age, it's like, I'm leaving before the encore is done because I want to beat traffic. Like, yep, that's the thing. Yep. But the thing yep. about Dave Matthews Band, that's what made me think of, because he has a bit about that in the special. So I don't know, man. Like, this is one of those things, like, I didn't walk out of this going, mad face. But it was more of a sort of like, well, goddamn it. And I was like, eh.
I was frustrated, I would say. You know, because there's just little dumb things. Like I said, like the fact that, like, spoopy ghosts can show up on the first floor. And in fact, as I just remembered, miles away in the finale.
Yeah.
Because despite all odds, Orange is the New Black and Praying Mantis Woman escape. And then a dude just shows up to kill them wherever the hell they are. Mm-hmm. So the ghost isn't tied to the bank. It's tied to the money.
Probably.
Or the intent. Also, there's a plot point of, like, they look at the money that they find, and all the bills are from 1982, which is this time of the original robbery that James Franco's ghost is from. In 1982, all your bills were not from 1982. Just like in 2018, all your bills, they don't recycle all the bills and make new ones every year. Like, that is fucking stupid. I love that revelation.
They're from 1982? The bills are from 1982? Fuck, they're all from 1982.
And they're like, 1982. Cool, we can spend them, which is the correct response. One of the few times that character is correct in anything she does. Mm. Like, it's just, they do so many things that you're like, brah, like, what? Like, you know, and so, you know, a stronger, I guess not an editor, because it's not the, like the literal editing of the movie, but like someone looking at that script and being like, do you think we could lose this angle? Could we tighten this up? Could we, you know, like someone should have had a little bit of a like, you're missing the boat here a few times. So,
To wrap it up,
as long as I'm on the Wikipedia, I'm going to point out this film has a box office, on Wikipedia at least, of $5,728, which makes me guess this was released in one theater for like one weekend. Just like a
contractual dump, yeah.
Yeah, just to say like it's been theatrically released, and now like you can sell it better to Netflix and shit, which is, I think, where we watched it. which is fine. It's interesting sometimes to see that like these movies will have these theatrical grosses of almost nothing. Because that wasn't the point. The whole point was always VOD or streaming services. But, yeah, even the stunt casting of James Franco and Orange is the New Black, like, I don't think that's enough to make you go, ooh, I got to see this, because they don't have much to do. James Franco's doing a great job, but he has a character that is actually interesting and sympathetic and wise. He's actually playing people off each other in this movie. Orange is the New Black chick is shrill and awful, just like all the other characters.
Yeah.
The plot is nonsensical and, like I said, breaks its own rules multiple times. And overall, it's just frustrating because you watch the movie, you start to get invested in, like, a spooky moment or in some tension with, like, the hostages, and then they break to something fucking dumb. And then you have to try to, like, look for the next thing to care about. And then when you finally find it, they snatch it away from you again. You know, it's like fly fishing for caring. So this is, I don't know. I'm going to say we're 4 out of 10 inside men that weren't.
Top inside men.
There you go. Top inside men.
Yeah, this is the blandest competent thing I can imagine. So I said a straight 5 out of 10. Dull is the new exciting.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of it's a bit of a bummer. So I'll say 4.5 just to split the difference. I'll say 4.5 out of 10. 4.5 out of 10, all the top 40 stations in Los Angeles be playing Crimson and Clover. What'd you talk about?
That was a weird. I'll, Everything that happens in that opening, the credit sequence is bizarre.
And the fires, and I just, what? I don't know.
It's one of those, like, sometimes the person who cuts the trailer hasn't seen the whole movie. That I is, got the no, feeling the person yeah. who did the credit sequence had no idea what this movie was about.
That could be.
They're just like, hey, it's ghosts and banks. Like, got it. Like, cool. Azalea Banks? Like, fuck off.
Yeah.
Okay, so our final movie of the week is Before I Wake, or Antes de Me Despierto. And this was originally done in 2014 by Mr. Michael Flanagan. And the studio that bought it, Relativity, went bankrupt.
Yep.
And so was unable to release it, and so it languished for a bit. It was originally called Somnia, and I wish
that's
that
a great
it
name.
Would have stayed Somnia. Because yeah. like Before I Wake is cool, but... To, and also, that would fit in with Oculus Absentia Somnia, you know?
Oh, hadn't even occurred to me, but yeah.
So, come on. What are you doing? What are you doing to my boy, Flanagan? There's a kid whose dreams manifest in reality, which is great when they're pleasant dreams and not so great when they're not.
The conceptually, like, the base mode of this movie is pretty neat, I thought. It's refreshingly original, because there's no fun way out of it.
Right.
Which a lot of horror movies, it's like, well, you just stake the vampire or you do it. And this one requires what our cold open gives us, which is a scared looking dude holding a gun on a toddler and being like, and then hearing a sound and being like, oh, and it's like, that's pretty fucked up like that. But then you, as you, the movie unfolds, you go, oh man, like.
Huh. Well, you unwind like, you unwind that ball of yarn. You're like, clearly the stakes are crazy high, and you're like, as you get to know that young man, and you watch them, and everything's going along, you know, in the early parts of it, you're like, well, maybe it'll be okay. Maybe it'll this will be all right because he's really sweet, and this should be good. And it's like, no, no, that's not how it's going to go.
One quick thing before we get into the plot, I give this movie 10 demerits. It will not affect my actual score. But 10 demerits for making Tom Jane, who is a very attractive man, look stupid the whole time. The
Point Break haircut.
With his yeah. Gerard Depardieu haircut.
Have you not watched 1922 yet?
No.
Ah.
But I was like, because it took me a second to confirm mentally that that was who it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, it sounds like Tom Jane. It looks sort of like a Tom Jane. It ain't quacking like a Tom Jane. Like it was
quacking of any kind.
It was, but no, it was just super upsetting. And then in the family portrait they have, I'm like, there he is. I'd fuck that guy. What have you done to him? Why do we not have the long haired version in the past? And then he was like, I gotta move on. I better cut this hair.
Right.
Wash this child right out of my hair.
I mean, maybe that's part of his grieving process.
I guess.
That he just stops taking care of himself.
Oh shit.
What?
Okay, that actually is very apt. There's a Lagwagon song called Razorburn about being dumped and growing a beard of shame. When I most recently got divorced, I grew a beard for that reason. And once I was emotionally over it, I finally shaved. And so I had like my long ass hobo beard. You remember for like over a year.
Yeah.
When I shaved that beard is when I felt ready to move on with my life.
Lovely.
So that very much could be what that was. And that is bizarre. Also very revelatory, this podcast.
I'm noticing shit this week. That's what I do. I drink and I notice things. Just real quick, the couple that, so this kid who his dreams become real has been bouncing around the foster care system because people tend to go missing around him. Also, people get freaked out around him. So he is then adopted by a couple who, like maybe a year prior, had lost their son because he drowned in the bathtub.
Flaw number one.
Yeah. The first thing we see of this couple is the dude is screwing a couple of handrails to the bathtub.
Yeah. Like handicapped bathroom stall style.
Yeah. Which to me, like, if my son were to die in my house, I'd
fucking move.
Burn the house down, yeah. You know, or at least move. So that's a little weird. But so they have this thing at stake where they need him to kind of help with the healing process, but at the same time, he can manifest their son to them if he's dreaming of his son. Yeah. So you get mom kind of like, oh, well, I wanted to take care of this kid, but he can show me, he can give me my
the
son
kid
back.
I really want, yeah.
So fuck him.
Mom is disgusting.
She gets throughout the pretty deep in.
Okay. Give me your perspective, Charlie. She's the villain of this movie.
No, she's not. Me.
Oh, she's a goddamn
not
monster.
By the end of it.
Oh, no, but she is the most undeserved reward I've ever seen in a film. That this movie made me very angry. So, but go ahead. Yeah, what do you think, Charlie?
People are human and make mistakes and treat each other badly I'm baffled by your response to that, because it's like, That's so far away from the relationship I had with this. Like, I saw this movie as having so much empathy, and like, it's a particularly cruel and unpleasant position that she puts him into to try to like heal that wound or whatever else. That's a human thing.
It like, is a thing a human can do. Yes, for sure.
I had a buddy of mine from college who had 9 blonde girlfriends in a row, because the first blonde girlfriend was the one he loved more than anything else, and she was an awful piece of shit and fucked him over to Tonight's Till Tuesday. And so then he kept dating girls that looked just like her. And it's like, and in some cases, like, it was, they were not good relationships, so it was a kind of rough go. But it's sort of like, that's a human thing. Like, human beings do dumb shit like that.
But the fact that it's human and dumb doesn't excuse it as being bad behavior.
But I didn't say it was good behavior. I'm saying it's human behavior.
Right. But I'm saying it is human and it's also evil.
But she's not a monster.
She is absolutely a monster.
I don't think she's a monster. She's exploiting. I think her motivation is understandable.
Understandable and evil.
Not evil.
I
don't like
entirely.
Evil as a word.
I absolutely do.
As general rule.
I think that she is victimizing an 8-year-old child for her own lack of being able to deal with her own grief. That's absolutely evil. You don't put your shit on a child. Like, that's not how the world works. We have to be better than
that. That is wrong, but it is not evil, nor does it make her a monster.
I disagree entirely, though.
I think,
but
if,
yeah.
I think for something to be evil or monstrous, it has to be
done with intent?
Well, deliberately.
Like it is after her husband calls it out on it?
Deliberately malicious.
Which is what she's doing.
What she's doing.
When her husband
malicious.
Says, we can't do this, you're exploiting this child, and she goes, no, I need this. You've been told what you're doing is wrong, and you're doing it anyway.
Selfish,
it is now.
Not malicious.
Selfish is evil.
Yeah, I don't like the word evil.
That's fine. You don't have to like the word.
From an evangelical background, I don't like the word evil.
Fair. But then like, pick whatever semantic word works for you. But it is the same thing. Everything she's doing is for her benefit
wrong.
And at the expense of the child. Wrong is often identical to evil. Not always, but often. There's wrong where you don't know better, and there's wrong where you do know better.
Evil is for people who believe in demons.
Disagree entirely, because I believe in nothing, but I believe there is evil. And so the idea that she is acting 100% out of self-motivation in this movie until the last 10 seconds after her husband is killed by her selfishness.
But self-motivation, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but self-motivation is, and forgive me for saying this, like, that's a very pompous way to word it, because like self-motivation, like, it's like she's like planning to like burgle her neighbor's house. It's sort of like, you know, she lost a child. I mean, it's sort of like she's going to behave irrationally. Like, I mean, you know, my brother gets killed by a drunk driver, so I go kill that fucker's family. It's like, well, you know, that's a bad thing to do. Murder is not good, but, you know, it was justified in my own mind because they took my brother away from me.
Right. It was justified in your own mind, but you were wrong.
She goes to
nothing she's doing is right or correct or fair or good.
She only goes too far when she drugs the kid. And she realizes that she has gone too far after she does it. You know, she's like.
But even that's debatable, though, because the doctor even says, like a child that has sleep deprivation at that age can cause a lot of damage. Like,
but she's doing
that. That's not why she's
doing it. That's not why she does it.
Yeah.
She does it purely out of self-interest.
And she knows.
For fuck's sake. Like, they put that in the movie for a reason. Flanagan's not an idiot. Like, they put that scene in there for a reason.
No, I'm not saying he's an idiot. I'm saying he gives us a character that is super flawed. And I was angry with that character for being
flawed.
How flawed she is. Yeah. I am flawed. I come from Sweden. But
to cut your hair in Mayberry.
No, I think everything about how she acts is a conscious choice, and I honestly think believable. The reason psychics, quote-unquote, exist is because people have trouble letting go of dead relatives. But you do not heal by thinking you can talk to someone from beyond the grave. You heal by realizing death is a part of life, moving on. she is simply doing the equivalent of going to see a tarot card reader every week. Instead, though, she's letting an 8-year-old keep himself up all night to do it.
Well, no, she's keeping him from staying up all night.
But the, she needs him to be sleep deprived enough to fall asleep. She's the one that's fucking, she's fucking with this kid, is the point. She's hurting a child in order to get what she
needs. I don't
think
she's hurting him. He's doing the staying awake about all on his own.
Yeah, she's trying to get him to sleep. He's trying not to hurt people. Well, she's trying to get him to sleep only because she wants to see her son. I don't think there's a single maternal instinct about the actual kid she has. It's all
up until her choice to drug him, though.
Have we explained what we're even talking about yet?
Yeah, up until...
Something about this is very confusing. Okay.
Up until the choice to drug him, she is not working to his detriment at all. She is seeing it as a win-win scenario. Kid needs to sleep. Kid has awesome dreams. I get to see my son. Kid feels better in the morning. It does not hurt him to be asleep.
No, I'll grant you. Well, I mean, it does, clearly. It physically does hurt him. She doesn't know that, though, so that's not her fault.
No, it doesn't hurt.
So, but I mean, I just think
it hurts everybody else.
Well, except that the canker man comes to attack him too. It hasn't actually killed him, and it probably can't. But
see,
therein
lies the thing, though. Like, I mean, I'm thinking about those of that movie.
The boogly thing.
Was it called?
Yeah, it is him.
The neighbor. The girl next door, or something. Where it's that true story. Is that like the real story that happened of like that family that like basically kind of kept that girl enslaved in their, and that kind of kept her chained up for a decade or whatever. And it's sort of like, it's like in this situation, it's sort of like, to me, like, you know, what you're describing is kind of more like if she were like, oh man, he can manifest his son. Cool. I'm going to get a neck chain and I'm willing to take every single picture I've ever had, every piece of video, and create a sensory deprivation chamber with only pictures of my son and audio and video. And I'm going to chain this little piece of shit in there and give him a feeding tube. And that's how I'll keep, and then with a bunch of sedatives. And that's how I'll have my son back. Like, to me, that's evil. To what she does, okay. what she does is extremely, like, not a good thing. I don't want to say it's a good thing, but it's like, I just think it's a human thing. Like, it's a human, you know, like, I mean, how many times do good people make a bad decision in a particular moment? How many times do people react poorly emotionally and just sort of lash out at the world? Does that mean fuck that person forever? Like, I don't know that that's fair.
Sometimes, yes, fuck that person forever. And we'd only see this tiny slice of life for this character, but the only part of this character I saw was her being at her shittiest. So I did not like her. I fucking hated her. The fact that Tom Jane dies and she does not pissed me off to no end. Because he has the same sense of, holy shit, I get my son back for a minute. And then suddenly realizes, this isn't good. This isn't helping us heal. We're exploiting this child to love another child more than him. That's not what we agreed to do. We agreed to foster this child.
Right.
And maybe I'm more sensitive because that's all I've ever known as far as children work. And, you know, that watching this movie and watching these two people desperately try to relate to a kid they've only just met that's already fully formed and 8 years old. My son and daughter were 8 and 1 when I met them. And it's like, I've been in this situation and boy, howdy, do you not talk about anything in your past that is not for a kid to talk about. That's, you don't put your shit on a kid. And so, again, this could be one of those things, because we've all got our movies we've talked about with that flip us out, but they're terrible for a while about this, and then Tom Jane comes to the, I think, correct, good human resolution in his mind. Sadly, he dies, and then Mom eventually goes, oh, I didn't learn anything except how your mom died. I don't feel like she got a good moral lesson. I feel like she found a way to make this kid feel okay, and now maybe they'll be all right. So I think at the end of the movie, yes, they will maybe.
Well, I think
have
she,
a good normal life.
I think she learned to let go of her.
I didn't
to
feel
let
it.
Go of Sean.
I didn't feel shit about that. Yeah, I don't
you
feel
have
any
the,
of that.
You have the whole scene with towards the end in the like orphanage or wherever he ends up, where she sees the family with the hollow eyes, which she sees her.
Mm-hmm.
Go up to the normal kid who, to me, represents Cody and fuck with his brain until he turns into Sean.
Yeah.
And I think she sees that and she learns from that.
Maybe.
Because she kind of embraces him.
I might have hated her enough by then.
Yeah, by the end of it, like, she literally embraces the monster that is inside of him. so that she can help.
I just feel like she in
better.
No way earned being the hero. And she's also Thomas Jane is the only one's the hero.
She's also still trying to get her husband back, but I mean, wouldn't you?
Sure, you know, but I don't know. Like, I feel like the dude who she goes to talk to in the asylum, who I couldn't figure out where I knew him from, and he plays Lieutenant Soap in the Punisher Warzone.
Huh. To me, he's Benvolio from the Romeo and Juliet with Leo DiCaprio.
Oh, fuck. I don't remember that one well enough. But I was like, I know I've seen this guy recently, and we had recently watched that. And I love that dude, because he's totally different in this. But, like, that's another example of someone who, to my knowledge, has not done anything shitty, but would desperately love to get his family back.
Right.
And was at the point of going, this is wicked dangerous. Maybe I should eliminate the threat. Which is a whole other way she could have gone. By the way, his choice is also bad. Like, you know.
Because there is a real lack of good choices.
There are
had.
No good choices here. Yeah. Aside from, like, try to be a normal person, you'll probably die. Mm-hmm. You know, the fucking social worker who warns them veiledly that everyone that's around this kid dies or disappears. And then when she goes, something's weird, she goes, well, you don't deserve to have him. It's like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
You clearly know that there's something fucked up. Also, the police going, why did you drug your kid? I'm like, oh, with the prescription he was given? One, how do they know she quote unquote drugged him? And two, that's not drugging your kid if you give him a prescription. That's just a plot hole.
Like, yeah, that was a little
that's
strange.
That's just stupid.
Well, for that sure. depends on dosage, though. You're making an assumption that the dosage that she gave him was accurate.
We weren't given any indication it wasn't, so there's no reason to expect otherwise.
I know, but there's no reason to not give it that credit either, Matt. Come on, man. You can't play one side or the other. That's silly.
Well, no, but I'm saying I'm giving her what I see her emotional character doing. I don't, maybe she did wickedly overdose him, but like, there's no like, hee hee, and doing like three drops. I would assume that they would have done that.
But I mean, like, you can't have one and not the other. I mean, that's not what I meant.
Two and not the one. Words.
You can't have one and then, but have the, shit.
You can't have a cake in your hand and.
No, I see what you mean. I can't have her be my evil villain and then also not overdose him.
Yeah, exactly. Cause I mean,
right,
like,
but the thing is, I don't think she would want to risk hurting or harming him because she needs him to get the dreams. She just wants him sleeping. He's still a child. A dose that would be appropriate would still be enough. I don't think there's a reason to overdose him on sleeping stuff.
Well, no, but there's not a scene of her in the pharmacy buying a case of Zzzquil. You know, like it's sort of, she talks to a doctor.
Well, when the police come in, they don't have that information yet.
Yeah.
I think is what it is.
The whole thing is just that scene is jarring.
No, what I mean is they don't have the information that she went to the doctor and got a prescription.
Well, except for the bomb in the medicine cabinet.
They know that the kid's not waking up because the kid is drugged.
Yeah.
So.
But why show it if it's so obvious?
In the situation where they're freaked out, they come into the house, the husband's gone. Yeah.
She has a big bruise on her face.
She's got a huge bruise and the kid won't wake up. So to me, that makes sense that the police would say, why did you drug your child?
Then it's a strange choice of things to show.
She said he won't wake up. He's drugged. And then
which
the
is
police,
also a stupid way to phrase it.
Yeah. The police who are in the middle of this investigation.
Yeah.
It makes sense that they would say that. I'll give them that.
Okay. If you put all that on. But that's the thing is like, that's the things I got hung up on in this, which again, like we all get hung up on certain movies. Definitely caught me.
Ladies' motivations. I don't think that's trifling, but, this whole police thing, rabbit hole.
Maybe, but it was bizarre to me. Cause that was the one thing where I was in her defense is that why I bring it up is that like, I was like, fuck you, police. Yeah. All she has to say is he was not drugged. He was given his appropriate medication in this bottle with his name on it as prescribed by a doctor.
And if she hadn't just seen her husband been eaten by Oogie Boogie. Maybe. I feel like she would
I just
have
feel like I,
phrased it better.
I can't picture a situation where when someone goes, what's with your son? And I go, I drugged him instead of, oh, he's knocked out because he took his sleeping pills from the doctor. Like, I would never use slang that would assume that my child would get taken away from me by Child Protective Services when talking to an officer of the
Unless
law.
Unless you had a TBI. But, you know, we'll get there.
Yeah, but then there's also the matter of
if you like the movie. And it's only not trifling if you don't like the movie.
Yeah, that's the same argument as The Fugitive. Like, the recording of Richard, he's trying to kill me. Like, oh, well, she's saying Richard's trying to kill him. Like, there's a comma, motherfucker. Come on, now. Shit.
But it was a
kid
comma.
Wasn't in a comma. He was just... just sleeping.
Oh, that's good.
By the way,
despite all of the arguing, I overall really like this movie. I just think the wrong person is given the hero.
Get the fuck off.
I can't because I hate what they did. I love how they did it. All this movie needs to do is have Tom Jane be given his satisfaction of learning, being able to raise the child as lovingly as he's been trying to, and her being punished for wickedly being selfish. Then it's a fucking Aesop's fable, and I love this movie.
Do you want Thomas Jane to be the Punisher, then?
Of her? Yes.
Okay.
There. Now we're all in the same pot.
Now we can let Charlie finish his sentence.
Yeah, sorry, Charlie.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, like, one of the things that's neat, and it's sad that this didn't come out when it was supposed to come out, but, like, you start to really see how Flanagan and the guys, the Newton brothers guys that they've done the last few scores and stuff. They're starting to get a look and an approach and kind of a texture to the way that he does his films, you know, like, Gerald's Game absolutely has it and Hush definitely has it. And, you know, like there's a look to him. There's a craftness to it, which is pretty darn neat. And I really like to see that because it's like, not because the director has to make the same movie 15 times, but because there's a craftsman-like quality to that. And I really quite appreciate that. One other thing I wanted to point out in this one that I really thought was pretty goddamn crazy was, you know how like in almost every movie ever, any kind of counseling or support group, those scenes are awful. Like this one was one of the few times I can remember in recent memory where that counseling scene, like, damn near made me tear up a couple times because it was just like, it was this really deep empathy.
It seemed very legit to me.
Yeah, it was like, it wasn't inflammatory, it wasn't one-linery, it was just like this very grounded kind of just like speaking past the screen in a way, but not being lectury. And it was like, I was very touched by those scenes. Like, I thought that was something pretty special going on there. And next time I see Flanagan, I'm going to ask him because it's like, that was really kind of special, I thought. Because most of the time in movies, that sucks. Those scenes are annoying. By the
way, Danny Elfman also has a score credit on this.
We were trying to figure out where that came in because we saw that credit too and we're like, what? So either he completely did something out of left field or we missed it? Like, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know how that would... I don't 100% know how that...
Because, normally you can recognize an Elfman score.
Right.
Oh,
you know?
So the funny thing is... Oh, sorry, Josh.
So Flanagan is on record saying, I don't think of this as a horror film. I think of it as more of a, like a dark fable. And to that, I can only say, did you watch it?
Yeah. Cause that monster turns his head around and my God.
Yeah. And there's some good shit. Yeah.
Drops the backward, like it's the head really drops good. And bends over backwards. There's a ton of, you know, hollowed out eyes and
shit
pure
in the
white eyes.
Moving.
Yeah,
well,
and
God
lingering.
Damn it, early on, when she drops the cup, when she drops the glass in the kitchen, I jumped off the couch. I went flat. It's like, shit.
And he's got, like, between Oculus, Ouija, and this, you can see his style of supernatural horror.
Yeah.
Where he really likes, you know, like, well, distort faces and, you know, black eyes and white eyes and whatever. But I'll take it, like, the Flanagan House style. For that kind
of
stuff,
I don't
decent.
Necessarily like all those movies as well as each other, but overall, like, Duder's competent in doing
it's
some
not,
good shit.
This one
he
is
knows what
not
he's
as
about.
Deeply creepy as Ouija was in moments. Didn't crawl as deep under my skin as that one did.
That was the prequel one we watched?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the one that was surprisingly good.
Where it's just, you'll have the girl with the black hole sun face, and it just lingers on it.
Yeah.
For fucking ever. But yeah, this one, I feel like... At the end, it goes too far into that, like, Mama, the end of Mama, which I thought was unsatisfying too, that Del Toro light. And I have to struggle to remember that I really liked the rest of it and only liked that okay. Mm-hmm. Like, as soon as she's, like, sitting with the notebook and then the fucking butterflies are flying around and I'm like, God damn it, it's the end of Mama again. It was a little too...
Those are
namby-pamby. So, I keep trying to remind myself, the rest of this movie is pretty damn cool. You got the scene with Cody is dreaming he's awake. and is kind of thrashing around and making Sean, the manifestation of Sean, going, "What's? I don't get it. I'm awake. I'm awake."
Like, yeah, God damn it.
Yeah, so there's some good Shudder moments in this too. What else can we say?
Oh, the other thing that I wanted to point out too was the I like, of course, the young man Jacob Tremblay, who was so great in Room. He's really good in this. But you know what? He's not. He's not shrill. He's not annoying. He's not sort of like precocious. He's sweet. And it's sort of like attention to all filmmakers. Like, not all kids are a combination of Bart Simpson and, and Seth Meyers. You know, like, it's just like kids can also just be adorable little bundles of kid. And I really thought that was a good choice because it makes him not only relatable, but it also really jacks between the second and third acts where you're like, well, maybe shit, is he actually evil, this kid? Like, is he actually like trying to be evil, like on purpose? Like, I wonder. And it's like, and that really there's a wrestle there, you know? Anchored by how Flanagan treats that little boy and how he portrays him and stuff. And I think that's cool. I really like that a lot. And I will freely admit that the thing at the end where she says the thing, and, you know, and then daddy got the best present of all and you see him with Sean, like, yep, totally teared up. Sorry. I'll admit it. I was just like, oh. You know, it's an interesting deal.
I think the kid is good, but I think he's given exactly one note to play throughout the entire thing. He's either screaming or he is the super gentle, kind kid, which makes some sense for the movie. But like, I wanted a little range because every time he talked, he was like an ASMR video. And again, I'm not trying to just be a dick because we've already argued about this movie, but like we talked about this while watching it, Megan and I, like, when is he going to talk like a kid? And I get it. He's got all this trauma, yada, yada. But at some point with the right amount of motivation, any kid forgets the shit that's going on and they're just going to like do a thing. And I felt like I was going, oh, you're making sure this kid is super gentle at all times to show that like he is the victim here. And like, I absolutely get that. And I never had a moment of wondering if the kid was evil. Maybe I didn't catch that, but like.
He is doing the Haley Joel Osment thing.
Yeah. And it was just like, it got a little grating by the end where it was like, I just want him to react to something a little differently. And he's always just the I'm sorry. I don't want to hurt anyone. I'll go to bed. And like, he does a lot of great things, like his little moments in his room where he like has just like the coffee grounds that he's stolen away in the filter.
That because when he does it's a little great sip moment. When he sips it and he goes,
ugh. But he goes back to it. It's like, yeah, the kid shows a ton of heart, but I can only think that that's a directorial choice is like only say your lines this way, you know, cause that is not that kid's speaking voice.
Mm-hmm.
That is that kid doing a soft voice. And it's like, just can he not use his human voice? Three or four times.
At the end, too, when he's like snuggled up with Kate Bosworth, he just looks bored.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, she's telling him the whole story of his mom and how she loved him and how she died. And he's just kind of like.
I mean, I think that's meant to be like a fairy tale he's being told and kind of him being thoughtful.
Yeah, but sleepy.
He just looks sleepy. Yeah. And which, again, sleepy would make sense. So, like, I don't know. Like, maybe again, they were achieving what they were going for, but it wasn't that engaging a couple times for me. And so I was just like, I think the kid's good. I would be happy to see this kid in other movies going forward because we've
Room.
Seen plenty of terrible child actors and like this kid holds it down. So I think it is a directing choice, not a him choice, but that it did wear on us as we were watching it where it's like, you're so sweet and saccharine and precocious and kind and unassuming. And it's like a kid that's totally silent gets annoying after a while. A kid that only speaks in ASMR is annoying after a while. Like,
maybe just kids in general get annoying after a while.
Oh, that's without question. But, you know, I wanted a little more variety in that performance, but he's too young for me to really blame him. So anyway.
So getting to, I would like to keep unpacking this, but we're at
some point we gotta sleep.
It's like 12:30.
Yeah,
we had a lot to say about Boys in the Trees. I feel like with this and Oculus both, as the movie...
Oculus is the mirror one.
Yeah. Right? As the movie progresses, it gets... By the end of it, the kind of horror gets a little subsumed. But like to me, the end of this was more in that Mama category where the end is unsatisfying because it is a little too fairy tale-y and a little too neatly wrapped up. And I would have liked to even end it before the bow and, you know, not put a bow on it, just have him, have her hug the canker man, have him turn back into the kid, and then have him walk out of the room with a butterfly flying behind him if you must. And, just let it go that way. I also would have liked to see everyone that vanished into canker man come out when canker man is gone. But, you know.
I guess it just depends on whatever the crazy rules of that are. Yeah.
So I, like I said, I was super unimpressed with the end of this, but at the same time enjoyed the rest of it. So I would, I'll put it at, let's say 7 out of 10, blue morphos.
Blue morphos. All right.
That's a big butterfly.
I know. I was impressed. It's a good pull. Charlie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you saw a few things differently. I'm really glad that Mike Flanagan makes movies. I think it's pretty cool to see their team of folks and what they get after. And I think it's pretty neat to see different things that they've been working on and how they've been honing the craft. So I think it's really rad. And I really like this quite a bit. And I think there's a lot of sweetness to it. So, I would say eight. I'll go up to eight because I really like this quite a bit. I would say 8 out of 10. 8 out of 10. Man, fucking 8-year-olds know how to make cold brew. Like, he just sucks at it. Like, I'm just going to say it straight up. Like, he's not good at it.
Well, I mean, living in Austin, you've grown accustomed to a certain level of cold brew.
And the hipster turtles make it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, again, like I said, I enjoyed this movie, and I know I've been super antagonistic about a specific character choice, but I think... All you need to do is make the character that, to me, was being built as the villain the entire time get her comeuppance. And you have Tom Jane, who's looking out for the kid's best interests, getting to the boy while she gets sucked into the thing. And then he continues nourishing the boy and gets through all the other shit. The ending could even be the same. And I'm perfectly happy with this movie. And maybe that's just like... for once me wanting the Pollyanna ending, but I just feel like she got the hero's ending that someone else deserved and that pissed me off. And that's my weird, perhaps overdeveloped sense of justice or bizarre ass morality that I'll admit makes no sense in my head. But, I have very strong lines for this, that, and the other in what I think about the world. And this one was just like at odds with them. And that infuriated me. That said, the ideas and the way it worked out were pretty fucking smart and fun, and it was certainly unique and gave you a really compelling villain with this little kid who just you might die in your sleep because of him, which is really interesting, you know. And the fact that they addressed that in the cold open was also, I think, a bold move, but one that pays off. And let that dude who, like I said, I only know from being Lieutenant Soap in the Punisher Warzone or whatever, pull off a really pretty good range while she's chatting with him in the asylum. I was like, oh shit, like you have a lot to say about this. Like this is interesting. So
God, overall, that scene, like, man, that scene is
it's a great
else.
Scene, and that could have completely sucked.
No,
you know,
for sure.
Like,
no, totally.
There's a lot of like, I gotta go see the catatonic so-and-so. And it's like, no, he's just a guy who knows he's not crazy and will never be let out of an asylum. Woof. Like, then I think that weariness is in him. Like, it's good. Like, he did a great job. But anyway, so overall, yeah, it's good. Your mileage may vary based on your baggage. So I'm gonna give this a 6.5 out of 10. Oh, I just forgot the name of the butterfly. The one that's not the monarch butterfly, but is the one that looks like it. What? No.
Madam. Yeah.
Is it a... No.
The Madam Butterfly, yeah.
No, the one that looks like a... It's something about kings or something. Or, no, Viceroy Butterfly is the one I'm thinking of. That looks like a monarch, but doesn't get eaten because birds think it's also poisonous like a monarch. So I was giving it a Viceroy because it's mostly a good movie, but not quite there. See, I had a point.
And it spends most of his lifespan talking about trade routes. It's very confusing.
Josh is just like squinting at me like, you motherfucker. It's late.
So we'll let that lie. And we'll be back in a sec with our films for next week. So you know what happens if you support us on Patreon at even a nominal level?
Mm-hmm.
I think, what, a $5 a month? Or is it less? It maybe could be $2. Who knows? We're going to change them in a bit anyway. But if you see fit to give us a little money for the podcast, which you're welcome not to, but if you do, you get to tell us what to do. And this week we had a Patreon patron who decided that he was going to tell us what to do because he has earned that right. So that is Mud Stuffin and the movies that he chose for us. By the way, right on, Mud.
Yeah, thank you, buddy.
Always up for commenting on Facebook threads and stuff. And I've got him on my personal Facebook and I enjoy hearing about things that he does in the world.
He has sent me many download codes for movies because he buys the physical copy and gives me the download, which... I mean, no, he doesn't, but that's how I got it yesterday. So, he's on my good list.
All right, so Mud rules, and so we're going to do what he says that we should do. So we're going to watch the 2005 joint Hide and Seek. We're going to watch The Others and The Orphanage and our short film, which he did not choose, but Matt chose and chose wisely, we hope, is Whisper.
Yeah.
And that will be posted on our webpage and on hshd.podbean.com. By the way, you can get the entire archive on horrorshowhotdog.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can get the last 10 episodes on iTunes. We're working on that. And you can get the last like year and a half,
give or take,
or so on Podbean as well. So pick where you want to see us and listen. Keep listening. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Josh, and I have been so this entire time, and we'll say unto you, bye.
Yeah. I know every now and again when we have an episode where I get particularly contentious, because it's usually me, I get a message from someone going, it's scary when mommy and daddy are fighting. We're good.
Yeah. Like, and it's never you that fights. You are just like the pillar that fights happen around.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I'm just willing to disagree vociferously. So please don't feel bad when we disagree. I honestly think that's some of the most interesting shit we do. So I still love Josh and Charlie. Mm. They can be wrong. I can be wrong. We don't even know who's who. It's going to be good. So thank you for tolerating me, my co-hosts, and dear listeners. So with that being said, as far as y'all know, I've been Matt this entire time, and I'm sorry.
This is Charlie Dunn and Austin. So if you really want to make Matt angry, Insidious, the new Insidious movies in theaters, and it has the audacity to treat people that study the paranormal as decent people. And so you should go see it, because Matt hates that.
I do hate that.
And this is Charlie Dunn and Austin. Take care. Have a very good week, and we'll talk to you, again real soon. Bye-bye.
Yeah. This has been fine all day. Now it's an open revolt.
That was the same problem I had at lab last night. Was doing okay. As soon as people got on stage, I'm like, and then I'm crinkling my thing, opening cough drops, and crinkling my thing, getting fucking Kleenexes. And Megan's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, I can't. It's crinkle season. I can't help. It's happening.
It's like, no, Chris Crinkle already came. You're done.
Is it? Oh, no, that's Chris Crackle, the one that gives you little mini candy bars that aren't Nestle Crunch.
Crackle.
Oh, such disdain for the Crackle.
The
Crackle is the one that saves the world.
They're the ones that always got that like chocolate ashy stuff on them that was always like, ugh, gross.
Yeah, that is fair.
Can we turn Charlie up a little bit?
Should I turn my gain up a little bit more?
No, you're good.
You're probably fine. We just had to bump up our tablet a little bit.
We had to pump up the volume.
Dance.
Talk hard.
Talk hard. Oh, you're not doing the movie?
Yeah.
Okay, that is how he did the jerk-off sound, as he smacks the back of his neck, which is the weirdest thing. I've never seen someone do that outside of that movie.
Yeah, and everybody going, whoa, is he really jerking off?
Like, it's like, yeah,
I don't know, dumbass, does it sound like that when you do it?
Yeah, I've never heard a jerk-off sound that sounds anything like jerking off, because jerking off mostly just sounds like tears.
Sobs and silence.
We should do movies.
It sounds like regret, Father.
That's what the sounds of silence was about.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. You're looking real fine. Okay, Cheswick. You guys can talk about Cheswick, and then I'll watch it later.
Cool.
Three, one.
Bless you.